Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Jesus, Peter, and Paul are the three persons in the New Testament that we know most about. In terms of theology, there would also be John, where we have the Gospel, the letters, Revelation, but we know very little about what John did in terms of his ministry. We can reconstruct some of that if we accept the later tradition that John was based in Ephesus, and so we have the letters, obviously, but in terms of, and there we would learn a lot about theological controversies, and pastoral ministry, but not so much about missionary ministry. So Jesus, Peter, and Paul are the three people that we learn most about. So I chose those three, not to have the figure three as a reflection of the Trinity, but that's just the result of what we have in the New Testament. A short introduction. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth, Genesis 1:1, and then after he had created Adam in his image, both male and female, commanding them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, Genesis 1:27-28. Then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good, Genesis 1:31. Now, after the eyes of Adam and Eve have been opened to see not only the good that God had created, but also the evil that they had helped introduce, they were banished to live outside of God's perfect world. They were sentenced to live among the pain, the toil, the sweat, the thorns, the thistles of a ground that had now been cursed. Genesis 3:16-24. And so God's mission to redeem the world is therefore addressed to a fallen world. The world is no longer perfect. The world is no longer a paradise. The world is still beautiful in many different ways, but it is a smaller world. Men and women are still creatures who have been created in the image of God, in distinction to the plants and the animals, but as human beings, we live outside of paradise. We are all rebels against God. And so when Jesus called his disciples to follow him and to be trained to fish for people, he called them to join his mission, which is, Luke 19:10, to seek out and save the lost. And people are lost precisely because they live outside of paradise. Now, the lost includes not only the notorious sinners who despise and flout the will of God, but in terms of Jesus' own context, the lost include righteous Jews. Jews who are righteous according to the requirements of the law. Jews who obey the law and to live according to the will of God. Think of the parable of the prodigal son. Which is actually maybe not really very aptly named. There are two sons. The first son is the prodigal son who gets lost. In German we call it das Gleichnis vom verlorenen Sohn, the parable of the lost son. And so the lost son, he denies that his father, in a sense, is relevant for him. He wants the inheritance, which the father gives to him, his portion. He goes to a pagan city, and Jesus preaching in Jerusalem. Now, obviously, this is only a story. It's fiction in a sense. It's a parable. It's not a reporting of an actual event, although these kind of things may actually have happened. In Galilee, you wouldn't have to go too far to come to a pagan city. Bethsaida, where Peter and John were from, was a pagan city, just on the other side of the Jordan River. He ends up with pigs, which of course for Jews is the lowest point to which you could sink if you have to eat the food of pigs. But then he repents. He returns to the father. And then there is the second son. The first son represents all those in Judea, in Galilee, who do not care about the will of God, who do not care about the Father. And Jesus said that his main target was sinners in that sense, people, sinners who did not care. But then there is the second son. He had always lived with the Father. He had always done the will of the Father. But now he comes back. He stands outside of the house. And now he sees how God has welcomed back his sinful brother. And the question is whether he will enter the house and join the festivities, or if he stays outside and then becomes lost. And the parable is open-ended. And that second son would certainly stand for the Pharisees and the scribes and the Sadducees, but especially the Pharisees, with whom Jesus had a lot of contact, people who wanted to do the will of God. Not all Pharisees were hypocrites. This is what Jesus says in Matthew 23, but there he speaks in Jerusalem. Last week of his life, where the Pharisees had determined, most of them, that Jesus is not doing sort of God's work. And so there he indicts the Pharisees. But throughout his ministry, he often had very positive encounters with the Pharisees. And the Pharisees were righteous according to the law. As Paul says about his time before his conversion in Philippians chapter 3, that as far as the righteousness demanded by the law is concerned, he was perfect. Paul was not arrogant. Perfect doesn't mean that he thought he never sinned. It simply means that when he sinned, he did what the law says you should do when you sin. You offer a sacrifice, or you immerse yourself in water, you do restitution, depending on how you had messed up. And so the lost, when Jesus says that he has come to seek and save the lost, includes first of all, those who had not even cared about the law. But it also includes those who had followed the law and who now see Jesus and God through Jesus rescuing everyone, even including tax collectors and prostitutes, sinners who didn't care about the law. And the question is whether the righteous in Israel now see that God is doing a new work through Jesus. And if they don't see that, then they become the lost. Then they are the lost. And therefore, Jesus addresses himself to notorious sinners, but also to Pharisees, to righteous Jews. And so that is the goal of Jesus' mission, that both notorious sinners and the righteous would be in the house of the Father, celebrating salvation, the new time of salvation. Now, the goal of God's mission now is not to bring about paradise. It is not to bring about the perfection of the world. Perfection is reestablished only when the first heaven and the first earth have passed away, when God creates a new heavens and a new earth, when God's holy city will come down from heaven to this earth. I'm referring obviously to Revelation chapter 20, 21, 22. The goal of God's mission now is for the people living in a seriously damaged world, which continues to exist, to seek out the lost, to find them, and to integrate them into the life in the house of the Father, in functioning communities where lives are being transformed. My talk has two main points. First, we look at the global perspective of the mission of Jesus, Peter, and Paul, and then we look at local strategy. So each of these two parts has 3 points. The first one has 4 points. As we first want to look quickly at the Old Testament, I could have taken that simply as an introductory point, if you like, a very nice symmetric structure. 2 points, each has 3 sub-points. Then you would take that brief Old Testament section simply as an introduction to point one. Let me define a few terms very quickly. What do we say when we refer to the missionary dimension some people have said in the past, well, the word mission doesn't occur in the New Testament. I would say it depends on your translation. If you're in the Greek, you of course have the word apostolos and apostello, which means to send. The mission derives from Latin. The Latin word mittere means to send. So mittere and apostello, Latin and Greek, means exactly the same thing, to send. Now, the word in Latin, mission or missio, was actually used in the history of the church relatively late for what the church was doing or was supposed to be doing. That was relatively late. But, of course, in the New Testament, we have the word apostello, to send. We have the word apostolos, apostle, the one who has been sent. And we have the noun apostole, the concept of sending or the reality of sending. And so the missionary, when we talk about mission, the missionary dimension involves the sending and going of followers of Jesus to people who are lost and need to be saved, to people who do not know the one true God and need to worship him, to people who have not heard of Jesus and who need to hear of him. So the definition of mission is therefore pretty easy, of missionary verb. Mission means sending. And of course, the one who sends is ultimately God, and then more narrowly, Jesus Christ. He sends out the 12. He sends the 12 into the whole world. He sends Peter. He chooses, he calls, and sends Paul. So mission involves sending and then going, because if there is no going, then there is no mission that is actually happening. Now, the going is from point A to point B. The distance between A and B is undetermined. There could be across the road, or it could be to the next town, or it could be to another Roman province. Let's say 50 years ago, 100 years ago, when we as Christians, now I didn't live 100 years ago, despite the way I look, there the word mission or missionary work was very often related to going to a different country. Where you need a passport, you need to learn a different language. And that, of course, was not the reality of Paul's ministry. In the Roman Empire, we don't have countries. We have nations, we have ethne nations, we have tribes, we have peoples, and then there are Roman provinces. That was the political entity, and the political entity underneath the province was the city. Some cities were independent, like Ephesus. Now still, controlled by Romans, although there was no Roman army. Most provinces, actually, the senatorial provinces didn't have Roman armies. You had only armies in the imperial provinces, and especially in border provinces, like Syria, where the Parthians created trouble. So you had the Roman governor in a province. His staff was usually actually pretty small, because the provinces essentially ran themselves. The cities had their own old institutions. They were running themselves. Cities controlled territory on which you might have smaller towns, at least villages. And so missionary work simply means to go from one place to another place where people need to hear of God and of Jesus. So we don't really talk about distance. We'll come back to that a little bit later. When we talk about missionary work, we talk about work. In other words, we talk about action. We don't talk about talk. We don't talk about having a conference or having a forum. We talk about actually working. And the work begins with going. We will get a little bit into Paul's missionary work, although I don't want to give too many statistics. In my book, Early Christian Mission, for each of Paul's, for every phase of Paul's missionary work, I do give kilometers or miles, how much he walked, because he would have walked. There was no, he didn't have a horse, it was too complicated. He had co-workers with him. So even the going itself was work, because shoes would wear out, clothing would wear out very quickly. Paul sometimes says that he was naked, even that his clothes were falling apart. I mean, not naked in the absolute kind of embarrassing sense, but that his clothes were falling apart. I have few pens that are only for in-house use. I can't use them to leave the house. It's too dangerous things. My wife said, I don't like to throw old pens away. So work begins. Missionary work begins with walking, and then of course it involves talking to people, counseling people. So it is talk, but it's not talk about mission. It is preaching the gospel, proclaiming the good news, helping people where they need help. We will use the terms missionary method or missionary strategy, just a brief definition. Most Christians actually throw the two terms together, they identify them. And most Christians, when they talk about missionary strategy, they actually mean method. But military folk, they distinguish the two, and it's helpful to distinguish. Strategy is the goal, and method tells you how to get there. To use a very basic definition. So when we speak of strategies, we refer to the goals of missionary work, to the overall plan for reaching the people with the gospel. And when we speak of method, we talk about their tactics. So tactics and strategy, they are two different things. Method is tactics. In other words, this refers to the way of doing evangelistic outreach, the implementation of the plan that Jesus, Peter, or Paul had to reach the gospel. So let's first talk about reaching the world, and then we talk about reaching people. So we first talk about the global dimension, and then hopefully even before the break, we start talking about local methods reaching people. First, a few brief comments about Old Testament realities. The world is affected by sin, therefore missionary work as God's mission targets the world. In the Old Testament, the logic of this connection can be seen in the covenant that God had granted Abraham, which combines a particularistic promise: you will have descendants and he would have land. So there's two of the promises are particularistic, referring to the biological descendants of Abraham. And then there's a universalistic promise: in you all families of the earth shall be blessed. Genesis 12, verse 3. Now there has been a debate about the verb, the form of the Hebrew word. Some have translated, in you the families of the earth will bless themselves. So if we interpret the Hebrew that way, then the families of the earth take some kind of initiative at some point. But it appears to be much more plausible in terms of how the construction works to interpret it in a reflective sense. In you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And it is somewhat open. Well, it's obvious that God who does the blessing, but it is left open how the blessing actually goes from Abram to the families of the earth. And that promise obviously was not fulfilled in an Old Testament context. There was no missionary work that Israel was doing. When you go to the Mosaic Law, which tells the people of Israel, the 12 tribe people of Israel, how to live, there are actually many provisions for how to deal with the Gentiles. Because as you know, not all Gentiles were removed from Israel. So there were pagans living among the Jews in some areas more than in others. And Israel is told to treat them well, to always remember that they were foreigners, aliens when they were in Egypt, and they were mistreated. And so when we talk about how to treat maybe refugees or foreigners in our midst, the Old Testament has a lot to teach us. There are some provisions what they should do during festivals like Passover and what they should be doing and should not be doing. But there's no, not even an inkling of the notion that it would be best if they would found faith in Yahweh and would become part of the Israelite people. There's no reference to conversion. the reference to what you do when a Gentile accepts faith. It would be obvious that we'd have to be circumcised because Israelites were circumcised, and that they would have to do the law, but whether there would be a ceremony, whether they would also have to be immersed in water. Later rabbis talked about that and discussed that. And of course we know that during the Old Testament period there were some pagans who joined the Jewish people, like Ruth, for example, the Moabite lady. Wonderful story. So it was possible. But it appears that pagans had to take the initiative. Now in the Psalms, we have statements or on occasion that call on the nations to worship Yahweh, but that is worship. And it's worship in the context of acknowledging God as the creator of the world. So Israel always knew that really all nations should worship God. But it appears that there was no missionary mandate in the Old Testament. People believed, like maybe 50 years ago, New Testament scholars especially believed that Israel had a missionary mandate. Old Testament scholars actually never saw that in the Old Testament. Someone wrote a dissertation, it's now somewhat old, 20 years ago or so, but still relevant. That dissertation surveyed Old Testament theologians and exegetes in the 19th century, 20th century, and they essentially all agree there is no missionary call. Now, there are missionary ideas in the Old Testament, many of them, but no missionary call, no missionary mandate. Now, you might say, well, what about Jonah? He actually proves my point. See, he was a prophet. He was a man of God. And yet when God asks him to go to Babylon, he doesn't want to go. He is rather prepared to die. And he nearly commits suicide, which is sort of not the ultimate sin, but a big sin in Judaism. Now, he says to the other people, throw me into the ocean. You see, he rather goes to a pagan country to escape Judea, to just get away. To get away maybe even from Yahweh, rather than have pagans come to faith in Yahweh. Now God gets him to the place where he wants him to go. That's always good to know, isn't it? If God wants us at some place, he will get us there. Sooner or later. Hopefully sooner. So, there were, during the Second Temple period, there were people, there were many pagans, how many we don't know, we have no statistics at all, but there were pagans who became proselytes, in other words, they had themselves circumcised and kept the law, but evidently they took the initiative. There is one passage in the New Testament that has suggested to many that there was a, as it was called, a proselyte mission of Jews evangelizing pagans at the time of Jesus. Jesus, when he indicts the Pharisees in Matthew 23, he says, well, some of you are willing to go through the seas and the land to make even one proselyte. It's actually not entirely sure what that means. That one passage can't bear the weight of a theory that there was a Jewish mission where we have no other evidence and actually some evidence to the contrary. Because proselyte is not really a technical term. The Greek word proselytos, proselyte is a Greek term, proselytos. It is not a technical term for a Jew becoming a Gentile becoming a Jew. It is a term for someone who is the adherent of something. So, when Jesus says, you Pharisees, you go through, let's say, the Roman world to make proselytes, he could mean that Jews who were worshipping as God-fearers, that they become Jews. Now, that in a sense would be mission. That is possible. But he also could be saying, you go through diaspora synagogues to turn Jews into Pharisees. Because if a Jew becomes a Pharisee, he can be called a proselytos as well. Now, in the Greek Old Testament, proselytos is sometimes used, and it is very often used, generally used, as a term for Gentiles becoming Jews in the Jewish text at the time. The word is very often used in this sense. So perhaps Jesus talks about Pharisees who are willing to go really very far to make sure that maybe that's the meaning, that those pagans who are already in synagogue, so they already believe out of their own initiative in Israel's God. These are the God-fearers that we encounter in the book of Acts, but they had not gone all the way. They had not been circumcised. But we also should not forget that when a pagan became a Jew, became a proselyte, he was a proselyte, and not only him, but his descendants as well. In other words, even though he had joined the Jewish people, the people of God, he was still not totally fully integrated. Because in the Talmud, we read about, like in some discussion, there's a reference to a person who is the son of a proselyte. So Jews didn't forget that they were not really born Jews. They don't come from the tribe of Judah, let's say, but proselytes. This is a little bit like our European countries, where if you have someone else living there and maybe even getting citizenship and speaking the language perfectly. I mean, could I as a German become a Czech or a Slovak or a French? Well, I could probably get citizenship. I don't know what the requirements are. And I could learn the language to speak it without any accent. Now, probably not. I'm too old to learn languages and speak it without any accent. But let's assume with the Lord's help and the help of a fantastic language helper, I would be able to do that. I still always would be the German who had become French, or the German who had become Czech. Would be true also, actually within Germany, where I'm from originally. If I move from southern Germany to northern Germany, I would always be the southern German due to my accent. I never can get away from my accent. There are probably only two countries in the world where this is different, Australia and the US. In the US, everyone is from somewhere. Now, when we moved to this, we were never treated as foreigners. So we were, and I could say pretty early, we as Americans, I felt actually rather bold saying that, but they didn't mind. Our friends didn't mind. But in Europe we know that sort of bloodlines and where your whole long family tradition comes from, that this is important. Well, as Christians we know this is not really important. That ethnicity is important in a cultural sense. Yes, we don't downplay that. But in Israel, that was so. So even when you were a pagan and became a proselyte, you were a proselyte. You were not Judah. You are not from the tribe of Judah. Now, a very important set of passages we find in Isaiah concerning mission. Still talking about the Old Testament, the global dimension of God's mission is expressed most explicitly in the prophets, particularly in Isaiah, and I want to limit my comments to Isaiah here. Isaiah prophesies that the Davidic king who is expected to come will judge the godless and reestablish righteousness, Isaiah 11, 3 through 5. And he would create peace not only in Israel but in all of creation, as he will fill the world with the knowledge of the Lord, drawing the Gentile nations unto himself. Isaiah 11, 6 through 11. So there we have that vision that the promise of Abram would be fulfilled. But very typically, Isaiah says, in the last days, when the Messiah comes. He doesn't use the word Messiah, but he talks about the Davidic king. And then he talks about the servant of the Lord. The servant of the Lord, whose ministry Isaiah prophesies, brings about the restoration of God's people, Isaiah 49:6. And he replaces the original servant Israel, Isaiah 43:9, who is deaf and blind, Isaiah 42. So the original servant is deaf and blind, even at the time of Isaiah. Therefore, he announces judgment over Israel. But there will be a new servant of the Lord, coming from among the people of God, a servant of the Lord, God would say. He takes God's righteousness or God's justice to the nations so that his salvation reaches to the end of the earth. Isaiah 49 verse 6. Now this servant suffers, and this suffering affects many nations, Isaiah 42, 15, as he atones for sins, Isaiah 53, verse 5. And so the servant is a covenant to the people, a light to the nations, opening the eyes of people who are blind and who sit in darkness, Isaiah 42, verse 6 and 7. As you may know, many of these passages I just referred to have been put to music by Handel in the oratorio, The Messiah. Yeah, I don't know, you young people, what music you listen to, but Bach and Handel, they wrote good music. We still listen to it today. Quite a bit of the music we listen to these days, it seems it's valid only for half a year or a year, and then we move to something else. But good music lasts. Anyway, what is nice actually about some pieces of Bach, if you know German, hardly any of Bach, I think, has been translated into English, but Handel's Messiah, that it's biblical passages that come to mind. And so some of these passages I can hardly read without hearing the music. I see some people nodding, it seems you know what I'm talking about. So Isaiah talks about the fact that the day will come when pagans will come to Mount Zion and inquire after the instructions of the Lord. So here you have the centrifugal aspect. The nations come, it seems they take the initiative. They come to Zion, ask about the Lord. They are drawn by God's redemptive acts. Isaiah 55, 3 through 5. Isaiah 56, 6 through 8. At this time, the nations will bring burnt offerings and other sacrifices. The temple will be a house of prayer for all peoples. Isaiah 56, verse 6. And this is, of course, what Jesus quotes in the temple when he kicks out those who were changing money and selling animal. So this vision promises the Gentiles participation on equal terms with Israel in eschatological salvation, meaning salvation in the last days. You see, Isaiah is not you Israelite leaders. This is what you should have been doing all along. Now he waits for the servant of the Lord who would come in the last days. It's then that the promise, the global universalistic promise to Abraham is fulfilled. Now the emphasis in most of Isaiah's prophecies is on the movement of the nations from the periphery to the center. There is a twofold centrifugal movement from Israel to the nations. The first movement is connected with the servant of the Lord, who as light of the nations carries the will of the Lord to the nations. Isaiah 42, verse 1, 6, and 7, and again, Isaiah 49, verse 6. The second movement, from the center to the periphery, is actually very interesting. It is connected with the survivors of Israel, whom Yahweh sends to the nations, so that foreigners may become priests and Levites. Isaiah 66, last chapter of Isaiah, last section virtually, Isaiah 66, 19 through 21. In the context of Isaiah 66, these survivors are either Jews who have survived God's judgment, or they are converted Gentiles from the neighboring nations who are sent to the more remote nations as the envoys of God. So there is an inkling, but again, it's in prophecy, looking forward towards the last days, that there would be a movement of Gentiles to Jerusalem, where they would be converted, and a reverse movement from the center, from Jerusalem, to actually the end of the earth. Now let's move to Jesus and talk about his ministry, call, and commission. In the handout, you see many passages. Obviously, I don't have time to give a good exposition of every single passage, but maybe you can use the handout and use it yourself in teaching that you do in your churches, and then expand that as you see fit. In Jesus' ministry, the global dimension is seen not so much in his actual work. Jesus stayed virtually always in Galilee. Sometimes he visited Jerusalem. And Galilee was a small place. Do you know the east-west extent of Galilee, which is about the same as north-south, roughly? About 40 kilometers, a marathon distance. Paul Turgot runs that in 2 hours, 5 minutes. No, not in Galilee, it's really. But in Chicago or in London or in Berlin, I think he's set the world record in Berlin, which is just under 2 hours, 5 minutes. So very small area. I mean, wherever you live, take 40 kilometers and think how far you get in 40 kilometers or 26 miles. Very, very, very narrow area. We are so used to, in the Gospels, having Jesus in Galilee, we hardly think about it. Could Jesus have traveled to, let's say, Egypt, Alexandria? Sure, his parents did. Took him along as a baby. It was easy to go to Egypt. From Galilee, you go to the coast, you turn left, you keep walking. After 2 or 3 weeks, you are in Egypt. Can't miss it. Could Jesus have gone to Rome? Sure. There were ships from Caesarea along the coast and then to Rome. Could Jesus have gone to Babylonia? Because there were large Jewish communities in Babylonia. Of course he could. You go to Damascus. You go further east. You go to Aleppo. You reach the Euphrates River. And then you go south. Very easy to do. It just takes a little bit of time. It takes walking. But people were used to walk. We in the U.S., we think God should have created us with wheels, perhaps. Is anyone here from the U.S.? We hardly walk. We are not really supposed to walk. In many places, there are no sidewalks. You drive everywhere. Europeans, of course, in Europe, we walk much more. In the inner city, you can't, it's not convenient to drive around very often, like when you go, so you park your car and then you walk. In antiquity, as you know, in the Old Testament, the word for walk is actually a metaphor for living, which is very typical. Because you would get up in the morning and you would be on your feet nearly the whole day. You would perhaps sit, you would probably sit for lunch, you would sit for dinner, then you lie down. If you are a farmer, you are on your feet all the time. If you are a shopkeeper, then maybe there's a stool on which you can sit. But you need to serve people, you need to get things. So the modern world is very different, isn't it? Where many, the profession of many people involves sitting, sitting on chairs in front of screens, in offices and so on. I don't even know what the percentage is of people having that kind of. But in the Old Testament, in the New Testament too, walking, like to walk before the Lord, that means to live in God's presence. Walk is a metaphor for life. So Jesus could easily have, no, you don't walk to Rome, you take a boat. But although in theory you could, but that would be an extremely long detail, so you would take a ship. But to Alexandria, to Babylonia, although Alexandria you could also use a ship, flying the coast would be very easy to do. To Babylonia you would walk. People were used to that. But Jesus stayed in Galilee. So Jesus' mission was not global. Jesus had some contact with Gentiles. We'll talk about that briefly in a minute. So it's more in the words of Jesus. That we find a global dimension. Now let's begin with the call and commission of the 12, Mark 1:17, with a parallel in Matthew 4:19. Jesus says, follow me, I will make you fish for people. The old RSV said, I will make you fishers of men. Man is really people. Anthropos is not man in terms of male, but people. Fishing for people. Now, the use of the term anthropos, anthropos simply means people. The question is, are Gentiles included? Now, in Jesus' ministry, where he stayed in Galilee, now, in Galilee, some Gentiles lived, Bethsaida, which is not really in Galilee politically, but it's right next to Galilee, on the border, on the northern part of the Sea of Galilee, there was a pagan city. So there were pagans very close by. But Jesus limited his ministry to Jews. And when he sent out the 12 on a mission trip, he said, don't go on the way to the Gentiles or the Samaritans, minister only to Jews. So when Jesus said, now this was very early actually in his ministry, when he began his ministry and chose the 12 disciples. So when he says fish for people, probably the disciples thought about Jews only, that the people would be Jews. But Matthew, who writes the gospel, and who ends the gospel with a great commission, go to the ends of the earth. Or rather, ends of the earth, that's Acts chapter 1 verse 8. We will talk about that too. It's something that Jesus said. But go to all nations. Go to all nations. So Matthew, when he writes this up, he probably thinks of Gentiles here as well. Jesus wants to bring in fish for people, for anyone, for Jews. And if Gentiles are in the area, you fish for them as well. Yeah, we'll talk about that passage again. If I forget, remind me what fishing actually means. It's a wonderful metaphor. But when we talk about method, so in the second part. So as Jesus calls the disciples and gives them explains what he wants to do with them, he describes their future mission in the most general terms, people. He doesn't say fish for sinful Jews, for apostate Jews, or for arrogant Pharisees, or for Sadducees who are cooperating with the Romans. He uses a very general term that can very easily include Gentiles. Then we have Jesus' encounters with Gentiles, which foreshadow the inclusion of non-Jews in the people of God. It's actually a little bit tricky what nomenclature, what terms to use for Gentiles. For some people, Gentiles is sort of a negative term. Pagans is a negative term. Non-Jew, no one ever said non-Jew in the first century, and you don't define yourself negatively. You are an American, so you wouldn't say, I am a non-French. I mean, this is pretty ridiculous, isn't it, to say that. So that is a little bit tricky. Of course, we could talk about Greeks and Romans and Lycaonians and Phrygians and so on and so forth, but then we need a lot of terms to describe the people that we need. So I will continue to refer to sometimes pagans to choose. Another term one can actually use is polytheists, people who worship a multitude of gods, because outside of Israel, everyone was doing that. So polytheists, which is a religious term, but works as a designation as well. Jesus encounters with Jews. Here we have the centurion in Capernaum, Matthew 8, the demon-possessed man in Gadara, also in Matthew 8, the woman in Syrophoenicia, Matthew 15, the mute deaf man in the Decapolis, Mark chapter 7, and the 4,000 people east of the Sea of Galilee, Mark 8. Because in Mark 8, Jesus moves to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, and even though Mark doesn't tell us, but Matthew has a parallel passage, not Luke, neither Mark nor Matthew tell us, but you know, on the eastern side of Galilee, that was pagan territory. Now, there were some Jewish communities living as well, but why did these people find Jesus attractive? Because of his miracles. Maybe not initially because of his teaching, because of his miracles. And Gentiles would want to be healed just as Jews. And the Gentiles lived there. So that crowd that witnessed the second multiplication of bread was largely a Gentile crowd, which again the gospel authors don't emphasize. So we shouldn't overemphasize it, but it is something that we need to take into account. So when Jesus encountered Gentiles, it is often said that the Gentiles took the initiative to contact Jesus. That is true for the centurion who wants his servant to be healed. It is true for the Syrophoenician woman who wants her child to be healed. She approaches him. But Jesus moves to the east side of Galilee and not to seek rest. When he moves to Syrophoenicia, which is just north of Galilee, the territory controlled by Tyre, there he went there to find rest with his disciples, sort of a retreat, some time off. And yet the woman heard he is in the area, and then she contacted him. But when he moved to the east side of the Sea of Galilee, there is no reference that Jesus wanted to have some rest. So that seems to have been a deliberate move of Jesus. Although, again, the fact that most of these people very probably were Gentiles is not actually mentioned. So we can really say Jesus moved to the east side to evangelize pagans, because the gospel authors don't actually say that. But there is more that happened than we actually find in the text if we see the geographical realities. Then we need to briefly talk about Jesus' prophetic action in the temple. Often this is referred to as the cleansing in the temple, which I think is a misnomer. The text actually never talks about a cleansing. These are our headings. If you have a Bible with subheadings, you find the word cleansing in the headings, but they are not inspired. Sorry to say, and maybe some of them need to be changed. What needs to be changed is the reference to Paul's first and second and third missionary journey. You'll see that later. Paul's first missionary journey was not his first journey. He had been doing missionary work for 10 years before that. So that's a serious misnomer or misdescription. Jesus didn't want to cleanse the temple and make it more pure. Because what happened as the result of Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection is that the temple is no longer needed in terms of forgiveness. This is why the temple was needed for the processes of atonement for sin and forgiveness through the sacrificial system. Why does Jesus do what he does? If you want to understand Jesus' action, we need to interpret what he says. And there are two references, two descriptions of what he says, or two items of what he says. First, he says, you have made the temple into a den of robbers. That term, den of robbers, occurs only once in the Greek, in the Old Testament, Hebrew Greek Old Testament, namely in Jeremiah 7, verse 11. And there it is also applied to the temple. And in that context, Jeremiah announces the destruction of it. Because a den of robbers you take up. So Jesus appears to announce the destruction of the temple. And then he says, this should be a house of worship for the nations. Now, of course, the nations couldn't worship in the temple. And Jesus was speaking not in the inner temple courts, but in the outer court, the court of the Gentiles, because there the temple precinct was surrounded on the four sides by huge colonnades, by huge colonnaded halls or stoas or porticos. This is where the early church met later on, in Solomon's portico. Huge, over 120 meters long, high also. This was like a public plaza. You could do whatever you wanted. So actually, when animals were sold and money was exchanged, they didn't break the law in any sense. Because in the Old Testament law that regulates the tabernacle, there is not even a court of Gentiles. They did nothing wrong. So when Jesus, would Jesus complain about the noise? That, I mean, that kind of activity would have been noisy. There were other meat markets. But you see, if you were a Jewish pilgrim from somewhere else, you couldn't bring your ox all the way from Syria as you walk. The ox may die on the way. Well, they would give you a few good steaks, but you couldn't offer it as a sacrificial animal. So you needed to buy in Jerusalem, but there were other meat markets. We actually know that from later Talmudic evidence. There were other meat markets where you could buy animals. you needed to pay the temple tax in shekels. And if you came from the provinces, you needed to exchange your money to be able to pay the temple tax in the currency that you needed to use. So this was actually necessary. It did not necessarily have to be done right there. You couldn't see inside the temple courts proper. If once you entered through the main gate into the court of the women, so-called, because women could only go that far, but that was the main entrance, all the men would go to the court of the women and then proceed to the court of the Israelites, where they would help with the sacrifice being then offered by the priest. That was separated by a high wall from what came around. And then there was a lower wall which prevented Gentiles. There were signs that said that Gentiles threatened Gentiles not to go further the pain of death. So Jesus announces the destruction of the temple, and he says, this will be a place of worship for all nations. Now, Jesus, did he mean that literally? It didn't happen in the first century. And then, of course, in AD 70, Jerusalem was destroyed. You probably know about Paul's collection that he put together in his churches, God's churches that he had established. We read about it in 1 Corinthians, in Romans, and especially 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. Luke doesn't mention it. He seems to hint at it in one or two places. But there was a whole group of people, and this is what Luke mentions, people who came with Paul. And they came from basically all the churches that Paul had established. So they represented the Gentile churches. And this is probably why this event was so important for Paul, that because this helps fulfill the prophecy of Isaiah that the Gentiles will come. Now, this was only a handful of people. It was not practical. You see, today travel is easy. We all enjoyed the forum. Could you imagine that all churches represented by us would come together to a place? That would be a huge group, an immense conference. I don't know whether Greg Pritchard, I can ask him. Maybe he should ask you to tell you how many people worship in your local church, and then he adds up 700 times, I don't know. This would be maybe 10, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 people. Could you have a conference let out that large? Yeah, in theory, but it's not practical. When Isaiah says the nations will come to Zion, Zion is actually not really very large. The Mount of Zion, if you have been to Israel, you know, very small. Now, the Temple Mount was a huge plaza. You could accommodate 70,000 people there. It was immense. That still exists today. If you see aerial pictures of Jerusalem, that huge structure where you have the Dome of the Rock and then the Al-Aqsa Mosque, that is the Temple Mount created by Herod. Herod the First, some call him the Great. This is a platform he constructed as he rebuilt the temple to resemble more like a Greek or a Roman temple. So Jesus, therefore, he announces the destruction of Jerusalem, which, as a matter of fact, would also destroy the temple. And he announces that the time that Isaiah had prophesied is now beginning. He announces the beginning of the Gentile mission. Therefore, it is not surprising at all that as he had trained the 12 after his resurrection, he sends them to whom? To all nations. It is at the end of Jesus' ministry, after Jesus' ministry, that the prophecy of Isaiah is being fulfilled, that the servant of the Lord, through his envoys, moves to the nations, moves to the end of the earth. So that's the global dimension. The global dimension of the mission of the 12 is most dramatically formulated when Jesus says, Matthew 28:18, all authority on heaven and on earth has been given to me. Jesus, who is the exalted Son of Man of Daniel 7 verse 14, is Lord over all people. When he says all authority in heaven and on earth has been given over me, this is what this means. that Jesus is the Lord over all the nations. The universal dimension of this statement also informs the word of commission that follows. We have first this statement of authority, and then we have the commission. Go to all nations. So we have all nations. The 12 are directed to make disciples of all nations, to teach all people in all places, everywhere, all things that I have commanded you, and Jesus' authority empowers them all days until the end of the earth. So the word all really informs the Great Commission on many different levels, in terms of geography, in terms of context. We are to teach everything that Jesus taught, and for us that also means everything that we have in Scripture, Old and especially the New Testament. We never dare only teach our favorite subject. And this is why expository preaching, I think, is generally the best preaching method. We take a book and then we teach the entire book. Then we never have to apologize for a topic we may bring up. You see, if you preach through 1 Corinthians, when you're in 1 Corinthians 6, you have to preach about the question whether Christians can go to prostitutes. When did you hear the last sermon about that topic? Would a pastor choose that sermon out of the blue? The congregation might wonder, who messed up? What did one of the elders do? Why does he preach about this topic? But if you preach consecutively, you never have to apologize for a topic that comes up. It's in the text. We need to preach the whole counsel of God. That's what Jesus said. And then this all also attaches to time. We preach all days until Jesus comes back. But it also attaches to the assurance and comfort that we have that Jesus is with us all the days until the end of the year. Since Jesus has all authority, there is no human or demonic authority that the disciples have to fear. Since Jesus sends them to all nations, there are no people, no matter where they live, or what their ethnicity or social status happens to be, who do not need to hear about Jesus. And since the risen Jesus is with the disciples all days, there is no time in which Jesus is not present. And therefore, there is no time in which the disciples may remain silent about the gospel. The famous phrase, all nations, panta ta ethne, all nations, refers to all peoples, including both the Jews and the Gentile nations. This global perspective then also becomes obvious in Acts chapter 1, verse 8. It appears that Jesus gave what we call the Great Commission to the disciples not only once, but several times. On the day of resurrection, according to John 20:21, where he says, as the Father has sent me, so I send you. And I mean, maybe just comment on that briefly. This is, at first sight, a very simple statement, like much in John, but then when you think about it, you are forced really to go deep. How did the Father send the Son? Jesus talked like a Jew, walked like a Jew, looked like a Jew. And so when we are sent by Jesus, we try to become the people as much as possible to whom we are sent. And so if, now there are some limits to adaptation. If you are white, you don't paint your face black if you go to Africa as a missionary, obviously. And if you are tall, my son is 6 feet 5, 2 meters. So if he would go, which is not his plan at the moment, as a missionary to Japan, or even to the Philippines where we were, what do? You can't reduce your size. So there are some things you can't. But you can dress like the local people. You can eat what the local people eat. That means, for example, to be very practical, that missionaries shouldn't take huge containers full of stuff to places to which they are sent as missionaries. You can buy everything you need local. And actually, local people will notice what you have in your house. Some missionaries build big mission stations, stock with stuff and maybe machinery that local people could never buy, could never maintain. And so they stay. They stay way too long. But missionary work is not about foreigners doing the work of the Lord, but to establish churches. And then the responsibility goes over rather sooner than later to local people. We can all sort of derive that from that statement by Jesus, as the Father has sent me, I send you. There was total identification. Now again, total identification is not possible. I think missionaries have still not completely figured out, and probably never will, how to do evangelism in a slum. I knew missionaries who lived in slums in Aberdeen, even with children. I don't know how long you want to do that. Our mission OMF would probably not have permitted that day he was with another mission. Because it's demeaning to live like people who live in a slum. It's not reflective of human dignity. And of course, when they get work, then they move out. So how do you do church planting? Very, very difficult proposition. I'm not a specialist in this. I've not even recently been reading about this. But there are some places. But Jesus became Jewish. Paul tells us he took upon himself sinful flesh. I mean, he didn't sin himself. But when the disciples became tired, he became tired. When they smelled after 2 days of walking, he would have smelled. Not of roses. He was a full, complete human being. He was a Jew. So there was a great commission given right on the day of the resurrection. Matthew 18 was evidently given in Galilee, that great commission. Acts chapter 1 verse 8 was given in Jerusalem, just before Jesus went back to the Father. So Jesus talked about the mission of the disciples that is now starting, that has a global dimension multiple times after he was crucified and raised from the dead. Very briefly, Acts 1:8, the ends of the earth. This could be simply a universal global statement. Go as far as you can. Go everywhere. But the term ends of the earth is actually used in the Greek and Roman geographical texts. The main geographer, Greek geographer, a rough and early contemporary of Jesus, was Strabo. He wrote, I don't know, over 30 books, I mean, relatively small books, if it's one huge work. But he has a long section about India, for example, but he talks about these matters. Other geographical writers do. The southern end of the earth was Ethiopia, what today would be Sudan. And Ethiopia is mentioned in the New Testament. Philip encounters an Ethiopian who is converted and then comes back. The western end of the earth is Spain, and Paul wants to go to Spain, evidently because there the gospel had not yet been preached. The northern end of the earth was not Britain. It could well have been because Britannia was integrated into the Roman imperial system in AD 30, but basically at the time of Jesus. And actually there was even a Greek mariner who saw the Arctic ice, who sailed north of Iceland and lived to tell the tale. Iceland was known. But the northern end of the earth, the term is, I mean, there might have been Greek texts. Many Greek texts have been lost. But what has survived is maybe only 10% or so. So the term end of the earth actually might have been used for Greek as well. But it is used for Scythia, which today is Ukraine and Belarus, the Crimean. And Paul mentions the Scythian in Colossians, where he says there is neither Jew nor Greek nor Scythian. Why does he add Scythian? Because we have the same phrase. In Galatians, there's neither Jew nor Greek. F. F. Proust in his commentary suggests there might have been a converted Scythian slave in the Colossian church. We don't know, but possible. He would have to be a slave. If as a Scythian, You don't have Scythian travelers in Asia Minor or tourists. Well, in theory, that would be possible. They were not regarded as enemies who would be captured or enslaved immediately. But it would be more likely he was a slave. It would be very possible. Herod the Great, his bodyguards were Germans, Josephus reports. So they were Germans living in Jerusalem. Maybe I should write a novel. That's what my children say. Dad, you should write a novel and finally start earning some money with the books that you write. And I have some plot with some obnoxious German or something. I don't know. So there were Scythian slaves. So this is quite possible. So this is the northern end of the earth. And then we have the eastern end of the earth. And that was the term end of the earth was used for India. And India at the time was the term for the region what today is Afghanistan and Pakistan. This area was ruled by the Persians. Then it was taken over by Alexander the Great. He actually walked all the way to India. And then there were indigenous states, and there is a tradition that we can certainly trace back explicitly to the 3rd century. There it stops, but it appears to be very plausible that the Apostle Thomas went to India. If that is true, he actually could have talked in Greek, in Taxila, for example. Taxila was the capital of the kingdom of Gondophares, so who is mentioned in the Acts of Thomas. There's a twofold tradition. The oral tradition of the Christians in Kerala, they are called Thomas Christians. They say, we have been founded, established our churches by Thomas. Now, they don't have documents to prove that, so that's a tradition. And that tradition can be traced back, I think, to the 4th century or 3rd century AD. But there is a document, a New Testament, apocryphal document called the Acts of Thomas, which I'm actually not really interested in so many historical factors like the Acts of the Apostles in the New Testament. The document, the texts were interested in theology and fasting and asceticism and so on. But it actually begins with the scene that the apostles met 12 years, which is very interesting. 12 years after Jesus' crucifixion. Now, Jesus was crucified, which is a date most people assume. Now, not Harold Holler, who wrote in like the Dictionary of Jesus and the Gospels, Dictionary of Paul and his letters, the entry on chronology. He dates the crucifixion 33 AD. Probably a majority of New Testament scholars dated to 30 AD. Now, truth is not determined by majorities, obviously. So at the end, you don't know. But 30 is perhaps more likely. So 30, if you add 12 years, we are in the year 41-42. What happened in 41-42? This is when Herod Agrippa I started a new wave of persecution against Christians. He executed James, imprisoned Paul, who evidently had been sentenced to death. He, at the next festival, he wants to execute him. Peter only is saved by a miracle as an angel helps him to get out of prison. And then he leaves Jerusalem. And maybe because Herod Agrippa went after James, after Peter, maybe the other remaining of the 12 felt that their life was in danger. Maybe they all left and embarked then on an international mission. We don't know. Luke doesn't tell us anything about Bartholomew or Matthew or the other disciples. He focuses on Peter and then on Paul. He's very selective in what he does. And there is much more that happened in terms of mission. But we don't know. When we meet Luke in God's New World, we can ask him, Luke, did you not have time to write about the other apostles? Would be nice to know. Because Luke gives us hints that he knows much more than actually. Like he doesn't tell us where Peter went. He only says he went to a different place. Yeah, how helpful is that? We would like to know, but he doesn't tell us because he now switches to Paul. And Luke probably thinks that if he would give a list of places where Peter went, then his readers would expect that he should give details about what Peter did. But he wants to now move on to Paul. So it is quite possible that, you see, this is a very interesting coincidence that the Acts of Thomas mentioned 12 years. That figure is never used in the book of Acts to date the persecution against the church. But what is described in Acts does suggest that the Acts of Thomas actually may be correct. That all the disciples left Jerusalem after 12 years and embarked on an international mission. If Thomas went to India, that was more challenging than Paul doing his missionary work in many different ways. Now, you could discuss Greek philosophy in Taxila, the capital of the kingdom of Gondophares. There was a contemporary of Paul, an itinerant philosopher with the name Philostratos. With the name Apollonius of Tyana. His life was written up by Philostratos, that's the author of the text. Apollonius of Tyana. Tyana is just north, it's north of Tarsus in Cappadocia. And he is said to have traveled to India. And actually, classical scholars don't have any problem with that idea. That he traveled to India and discussed Greek philosophy with the people there in Taxila. So there would have been Greek speakers, maybe some Aramaic speakers. Now, there were also Hindus, there were Buddhists in terms of their religion, Hindus in terms of their language. But that would be more cross-cultural than what Paul did. Paul's missionary ministry was not really cross-cultural for him. He was bicultural. He lived in two cultures. I don't know, you are, what background are you? Hong Kong. So, and where do you, and did you speak English in Hong Kong? No, or only Cantonese? Because many Chinese who live in Hong Kong and more so probably in Singapore but also in Taiwan, they are really bilingual and bicultural. So Chinese culture, especially from their parents, and then modern Western culture, there are many people like Paul was like that. He grew up in Tarsus, he was a natural native Greek speaker, as he was a native Hebrew and Aramaic speaker. So Paul didn't really, in the eyes of others he crossed cultures, but he himself didn't really cross cultures because he knew both cultures intimately. He had lived in both cultures. You say in Hong Kong, I repeat that for the recording, you say that in Hong Kong, Chinese culture, the culture, let's say, of the Chinese people and Western culture sort of merges. That is indeed true. Sort of Greek ideas and Greek culture, even Greek names, had been in Judea in the Near East really for 300 years since Alexander the Great. Many high priestly families gave Greek names to their children rather than Old Testament names or Hebrew names. Still, there were obviously some differences in terms of outlook, in terms of even what you could do, what the law would allow you to do. But it was not as different as, let's say, Western European culture and the culture of an African country, especially if you go to the countryside. Or if you go to China and go to the countryside. Hong Kong is different, and maybe Beijing and Shanghai are also different, but if you go into rural areas, there the older traditions would be much more stronger. There is evidence that the 12 apostles perhaps took Acts chapter 1 verse 8 literally, ends of the earth, literally, because ends of the earth could be identified with a certain what we would call countries or regions, or in the case of Spain, provinces. Scythia was not a province, obviously. Ethiopia was not a province. India was not a Roman province, but Spain was. Actually, there were three Roman provinces in Spain. Spain was divided into three provinces. So that they could very well have taken that, not just in general global terms, but literally. This is where they where Jesus had sent them, and this is where ultimately they wanted to go. To finish the section about Jesus, I want to briefly refer to Diognetus 5, 1 through 5. This is in the handout. Diognetus was an elder in the church in Rome. We don't know who the author is. This letter was written in AD 150. So one of the very earliest Christian documents outside of the New Testament. And there, very well, in a sense, not really surprisingly, we find cultural openness and the willingness to adapt to local foreign cultures. The unknown author writes, "For Christians are no different from other people in terms of their country, language, or customs. Nowhere do they inhabit cities of their own, use a strange dialect, or live life out of the ordinary. They inhabit both Greek and barbarian cities, according to the lot assigned to each, and they show forth the character of their own citizenship." In other words, Christians have a heavenly citizenship. "Their own citizenship in a marvelous and admittedly paradoxical way by following local customs in what they wear and what they eat and in the rest of their lives. They live in their respective countries, but only as resident aliens." And that might be a reference to 1 Peter verse 1 and 2, where Peter writes to evidently unbelievers, to Gentile Christians, who live among unbelievers as resident aliens. They live in Northern Asia Minor as resident aliens. They, in that letter to the Galatians, we continue to read, they participate in all things as citizens, and they endure all things as foreigners. Every foreign territory is a homeland for them. Every homeland, foreign territory. They are not really at home. This is perhaps, and I don't want to start preaching, but that's a good topic to preach on too. Peter 1:1, that as Christians, that there's always something that we are uncomfortable about. Maybe a decision our governments make, or some new law that is being enacted. In many countries now, homosexual marriage becomes enacted as law. And that makes, and rightly so, many Christians feel very, very uncomfortable. Not that it impacts their lives directly, but you wonder, what is that country I am actually living in, where these kind of things become possible? Of course, we could talk about abortion. How many unborn children are being killed every day? Millions and millions every year throughout the world. We live in this country. So there are many things we don't accept, we deplore, we mourn about. Things people do in their free time that perhaps as Christians we can't participate in, when you think of drugs and getting drunk with the elbow and so on and so forth. But we live amongst the people. We don't live in our own city. So here we see something of their global dimension, 150, sort of taking Jesus seriously. Christians live everywhere. Peter's global missionary vision. We have our break at 10:20, so this is in 15 minutes. And I said I want to begin with the second part. I'm not a prophet nor the son of a prophet, I can tell you. But I at least want to finish the first part. And we also want to have time for discussion. With Peter, perhaps let me do this very quickly. Acts chapter 2, Paul explains the coming of the Holy Spirit, he explains the life of Jesus and that Jesus is the Messiah, that he has been raised from the dead, that he is indeed Messiah and Kyrios, and then Jews are deeply struck by what Peter has been preaching, and they ask him what they should do. And Peter says, repent. Be immersed or baptized, every one of you, in the name of Jesus the Messiah, for the forgiveness of sins, and you will receive the Holy Spirit. And now it comes, for the promises for you and for your children and for all those who are far away, whom the Lord our God will call to himself. For you and your children, you, it's obvious that this salvation is relevant for the immediate audience of Peter, but he says it's also relevant for your children. So this implies distance in time. God's promise of the Holy Spirit becomes reality through faith in Jesus for subsequent Jewish generations. But then he also says, and for those who are far away, for those from afar. Now, some New Testament scholars suggested that this was related to Jews in the diaspora, but that's not plausible, really. I think it does refer to Gentiles. That right at Pentecost, we should not forget, the Great Commission to go to all nations has been given to the 12. Now, of course, liberal New Testament scholars don't believe there was ever any resurrection, so there is no Great Commission. This is a later apostolic invention, but what do they know? So there is a reference to Jews in the future receiving salvation, but also to Gentiles. One argument to support that is obviously the Abrahamic promise included a promise for the families of the nation. And as Jesus' ministry was about fulfillment of the Old Testament promises concerning salvation, as Jesus had talked about their task being a mission to the nations, so therefore here those who are far away receive the nations as Peter had contacts with Gentiles. Chapter 8, we find Peter in Samaritan cities, towns, and villages. Now Philip was there first, but Jerusalem church sent Peter and John to Samaria. And so there's actually a reference to the fact that as they went back, they preached the gospel, Peter and John did, in Samaritan cities, towns, and villages. And then, of course, we have Acts chapter 10 and the first part of 11. The episode of Peter and in Caesarea bringing to faith or proclaiming the gospel before a Roman centurion. If you want to talk more about that particular incident, we could do that. God sends a threefold vision. The vision is repeated three times. A cloth full of unclean animals telling people eat. And Peter must have thought that this is a temptation by the devil. See, not every dream is a good dream. Not every dream conveys a message from God. Dreams could be inspired by Satan, or maybe by our own psychology. It was around noon, and he was hungry. He was praying on the roof. So maybe he thought, this is just crazy. Because these were animals he was not allowed to eat. That's what he says, that he's not allowed to eat them. The law prohibits it. But this is repeated three times. And then there are these envoys from this Roman centurion who invite him to come to Caesarea, because God had appealed to Cornelius. So obviously there is a confirmation that it is really God's will that he should go to Cornelius. And then he says, he reports to Cornelius about this dream vision and says, so God had shown me, I paraphrase, not to treat any Gentile as unclean. In other words, this vision indicates very clearly that the purity laws of the Old Testament no longer apply. Jesus had already intimated that when he said in Mark 7 that what makes people unclean is not what goes into their body, but what comes out of their mouth. According to Jewish law, of course, what goes into your body defiles you, makes you unclean. If a Jew eats pork, he becomes unclean, but no longer. At least Gentiles should not be regarded unclean. And this is what Peter had to learn promptly when he comes back to Jerusalem, maybe some weeks later, because he stays in Caesarea for a few days. And then maybe he continues his ministry in the Shephelah, in the hill area, between the hill country, the mountain country, the mountain region of Jerusalem and the coast. He returns, and immediately his Jewish friends in the church say, we have heard that you ate with Gentiles, you stayed with them. And so he explains, and the church then accepts that. That particular discussion, of course, continued. There were later Pharisees who were converted and who evidently it was Pharisaic believers, converts to the Christian faith, who insisted that the Gentiles need to be circumcised in order to be full members of God's people. But very early on, the church had decided that Cornelius doesn't need to be circumcised, because he received the Holy Spirit in exactly the same way that the apostles had. So there was no doubt. God had accepted Cornelius, and so therefore they need to accept him as well. So maybe some of the conservative Jewish Christians believe, well, Cornelius is a Roman Roman centurion. He has with that job obligations, and so maybe we make an exception for divine circumcision. He can really become a Jew. Otherwise, he loses his job, and it's good to have someone in that position to potentially protect us. We don't know whether they thought along those lines, but definitely later there was more discussion about it. Let's go to Paul. Paul's global missionary strategy, and he comments in 1 Corinthians 9 about the fact that he preaches to both Jews and Gentiles. Paul, of course, doesn't use the word global, but he preaches the gospel to all who are willing to listen. And he says specifically in chapter 9 to that he becomes a Jew to Jews and a Gentile to Gentiles. So when you talk about Jews and Gentiles, you talk about the entire world. So that's the global dimension. And the reason for this is obviously theological. There is no distinction between Jews and Gentiles as regards their status before God as sinners. It is only through Jesus that sins are forgiven. In Romans 1:14, we see a social he says that he's a debtor both to Greeks and to barbarians, so that's a social dimension. The Greeks, the barbarians, the wise and the foolish. The wise would be those with education, and the foolish those without education. And so Paul says that he speaks to people and wants to reach people irrespective of their ethnic identity or their cultural affiliation or the level of their education. Paul, that's not special. He preaches the gospel to everyone. And so we find Paul in contact, and I wrote this out in the handout, with Jews, with proselytes, with God-fearers, with pagans, with slaves, with beggars, with philosophers, with members of the municipal elites, with Roman governors, with synagogue officials, with women. If you actually, I give you the references, you can look them up. It's actually pretty amazing the scope, the range of people with whom Paul is in contact. He does not only mission among the high-profile people, he talks to beggars. We have a few minutes before the break. Are there any questions on this path? The question is, what reliable information do we get about Jesus outside of the Gospels? There is not really very much. There are some, F.F. Bruce has written a nice book some years ago, obviously, about information about Jesus outside the gospel. So there you would get the references and the text. These are very brief references only. It confirms that people in antiquity knew that Jesus existed, that he lived. There's a very famous passage in Josephus about Jesus, although there has been a big debate whether this was interpolated by Christians later, because Josephus' texts were preserved by Christians, like in monasteries, not by, well, by Jews probably as well. They would read him, but the manuscripts that we have, they are all Christian manuscripts. And there is actually a line that Jesus is Messiah, Son of God. Most scholars today, not all, they still are controversy, but most scholars who work on this issue, they think that the passage basically is authentic, but that it has been changed by Christians later on. At least that phrase, that he was the Messiah, Son of God. Josephus would not say that. He would say he claimed to be Messiah, Son of God, but that's not actually what we say. Well, there is no term where Jews would always exclude themselves. That's part of the problem. So we need to read every passage and see, are Jews part of that? Like when we talk about the nations of the earth, ethne, then Israel is also ethnos. But then the word laos, in the Old Testament, usually the word laos, people, a people is not people in terms of, excuse me, that we are all people and not animals. The word Laos is usually the term most references use the word Laos in Greek. Am would be the Hebrew, but when you read the Greek translation of the Old Testament for Israel. But there are some passages where other nations are also called Laos or Laoi. So there is no term in the Old Testament that is reserved exclusively for Israel and a term that would be exclusively used for pagans. And that indeed creates a problem in translation. So sometimes we may have to put in pagan nations or the Jewish people if the Jewish people are meant. And so that is indeed a challenge. And this is why we have the debate concerning the Great Commission in Matthew 18, Matthew 28, verse 18, 19, and 20, whether go to all nations, Israel is excluded. Many wanted to argue that Israel is excluded. Some New Testament scholars say, for Matthew, God has judged Israel, or the Jews. They have no more chance, so it's only Gentiles. But it's actually a misreading of Matthew. Yeah, there is judgment, but there is also still, and of course we see that in Acts when we take it as a historical perspective. There seems to have been no Jewish Christian, and Matthew certainly was a Jewish Christian, who would exclude the Jews from as an audience for the proclamation of the gospel. But the terminology is interesting, and we still struggle with that. Of course, today, if you speak to Jews today, we are goyim, we are boys, and they are Jews. So that is there are these terms that are used. But the Hebrew term goyim, as used in the Old Testament, is a term usually for pagan nations. But if I remember correctly, Israel can be called a goy as well, a people. Or the question more specifically, we have a Johannine tradition, and yet it is not very historical. I don't have an explanation for that. We just have to deal with what we have got. So we certainly have a Pauline tradition, you might say Paul's letters, and we have a Petrine tradition, as Luke writes about him in Acts, and of course he writes about Paul. So in Luke we have a Petrine tradition and a Johannine and a Pauline tradition, but Luke only mentions John a few times, that he was in prison, he prayed in the temple. But we have the Gospel of John, the letters of John, Revelation. According to early Christian tradition, all these texts were written by the same person, but that's later tradition. Not everyone today agrees with that. So even that would have been discussed, whether we talk exactly about the same person having written all these documents, because John or Johannes was a somewhat common name. So other people could have had that name as well, and the authors, for example, of Revelation. And of course, the Gospel of John doesn't mention an author, but there we have again the early Christian tradition that I think. Yeah, we do not know. We don't know whether Luke wanted to write a third volume, first volume being Luke, the Gospel, and then Acts, the second volume. Because he doesn't report the outcome of the trial against Paul. And yet he devotes nearly one third of his book to Paul in prison. And the trials in Jerusalem, in Caesarea, then waiting in Rome. Did Luke die relatively early when he wanted to continue to write? Or did he not know what happened to Paul? There are all kinds of possibilities and theories. In the third volume, would he have written about the other apostles and where they went and what they did? One day we can ask him, but not now. So there is no answer, really. There is nothing, because Eusebius doesn't really give us much more details about John or the others. Well, we do learn John was in Ephesus. So there we learn a few historical facts, but not really very much. If we do believe that the three letters were written by John, who wrote the Gospel and who was Jesus' disciple, then by mirror reading these letters, we can deduce a little bit about the challenges that he faced, about his pastoral heart, pastoral ministry. But we know more about Timothy and his movements and how Paul used him in his mission. We know more about Timothy than about John. Without a local focus, global strategies remain mere talk. When Jesus called the 12 to fish for people and commissioned them to go to all the nations, he sent them to real people living in real cities. He didn't devise a think tank in Jerusalem with his followers talking among themselves, but he sent them to the towns, cities, towns, villages, and the people living there in Judea, Samaria, and beyond. And therefore, when we talk about, let's say, in conferences and so on, about missionary strategies, we always need to talk about local realities. We always need to talk about people. Because otherwise, we are not really, so we might be talking about all kinds of things, which even might be helpful, but we are not really talking about what we would call missions. Now, what did Jesus actually do? You can easily do this study yourself. For point number 2.1, I didn't give you, I think in the handout, I gave you only some scripture passages, no details, but you can go to Mark 4, which is the first chapter of Jesus' public ministry, Matthew chapter 4, the chapter just before the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 1 to 3, sort of the infancy material, introductory material, John the Baptist. Or you could go to Mark chapter 1, Jesus' public ministry, and you can start there. And you can print out the text, or maybe you underline in your Bible, I don't know, and look at all the verbs. And then group the verbs under different categories. And it's pretty amazing what you get. Jesus left Jerusalem. In other words, he walked. He went and lived in Capernaum, Matthew 4:12. He was walking by the sea. He saw two brothers. He called them to follow him. Then he went on and saw two other brothers. And then we have summary statements that Jesus went throughout Galilee, that he taught in synagogues. He proclaimed the good news of the kingdom. He healed the sick. And the next chapter, Matthew 5, begins with a statement. Jesus saw the crowds. He went up on the mountainsides. He sat down. He began to teach. Sort of there, the reporting is slowing down. We find that in Luke, in Acts especially. Sometimes Luke needs only five words to cover maybe 2 or 3 months of Paul's ministry. And sometimes he describes every bodily movement in detail in maybe 1 or 2 verses. Like the healing of the lame man in chapter 3, every little detail is explained. And it's interesting to note that. So this is one way of doing Bible studies, that you could look at the nouns that are being used. Of course, you know, when you read any biblical text, you can ask the question, what do we learn about God? And then you can write it out. What do we learn about us, the human condition? What do we learn about salvation? So those three areas. What you can also do is look at the verbs, especially for this topic in the Gospels. In Mark 1, several of the incidents after Jesus' testing in the wilderness are identical to Matthew. He also relates that Jesus went with his disciples to Capernaum. He went into the synagogue. He began to teach. He rebuked and drove out the spirit. Then one day he got up early in the morning. He left their house. He went off to a solitary place. So if you look at the details of what the gospel authors say, you get a lot of movement. So Jesus' activities are described. These would be categories that you probably would find at the end. Geographical movement, verbs of seeing, verbs describing bodily movements, and many verbs of speaking. Often the same words are used in Greek or in the translation that you are using. So verbs of geographical movement and verbs are speaking, they are very, very common. I mentioned the fact that the area of Galilee is very small, only 40 kilometers from east to west. We know roughly how many towns and villages existed. Many were very small, like Nazareth had probably not more than 100 inhabitants or so, very small places. So Jesus probably visited every town and village in Galilee multiple times. Because you need, if you take, let's say, a week in each place, you need only 3 weeks or so to cover the whole thing. Which means that when Jesus sends out the disciples and says, stay in the place where they invite you, in other words, you can expect hospitality, he can say that because Jesus is known in all these places. He has sympathizers in all these places. So let me briefly talk about this metaphor to feed four people. The first 3 points are from a John Stott sermon. The fourth is by me. First point, fishermen have a specific goal. They want to catch fish. So if you would go out for fishing in the morning and you come back at noon and let's say you are married and your wife says, how was fishing? And you say, well, I observed 10 fish. And how they circled around the lure and swam in the water. It was so beautiful. What would your wife tell you? Buy a fish tank, buy an aquarium. Fishermen want to catch fish. I mean, even if you do the catch and release, if you don't want to eat the fish, you want to actually catch the fish. And I thought all that, always when I heard this, this is really very helpful. Our goal is not just to have good conversations. Our goal is not to impress people. Our goal is not just to be able, let's say, with the report that we heard, to actually address, let's say, students in the high school in the country in which we minister. I mean, we want that. But our goal is that people actually come to faith. Now, we can't force people. Every conversion is a miracle. God only converts people. But that is the goal. That's what we want. The second point is that fishermen need a teacher. How many of you have been fishing? Yeah, several of you. In the U.S., many fish. In Europe, I think it's much rarer. In the U.S., many fish, and the father teaches the sons and the daughters. Perhaps you pick it up from somewhere. When we went up to Canada from Chicago to the in Ontario to the Frank Brewer system. We had rented a little cabin. You couldn't even get there with a car. You needed a little boat. So we knew we would want to do some fishing. And I had no idea. So I bought the book Fishing for Dummies. Now, in that title, the dummy would be not the fish. Fishing for Dummies, not the fish, but me. Although I thought any fish who is willing to be caught by me, that really was better. You see, you need to know a few things. You need to know what kind of fish do you want to get. And are they low or are they high? Do you fish when the sun is out or more in the shade? You need to know. Otherwise, you don't fish anything. Of course, even if you are an expert fisher, you may not find the fish. But you need to know. And who is the teacher? The teacher is Jesus. For the disciples, and when I apply that, let's say in a sermon, I always say, Jesus still is our teacher. Not a seminary prof or someone who gives a seminar on how to do evangelism. And of course, we can learn from other people. But at the end of the day, we learn from Jesus. Loving people. Because evangelism is really eventually not about technique, about method, but about loving. And wanting to talk. If you think about the church in China, 1 million Christians in 1948-52 when Mao Zedong took over. Today, 50 million. They were not trained in personal evangelism. The pastors were in prison. They would just talk. And that's the greatest church growth in the history of the church. It's loving people and wanting to talk. And this is what we learn from Jesus. He was tireless. He talked to everyone. And again, when we look at the whole picture that is given to us in the gospel, Jesus talks to crowds, and he talks to individuals. He talks to scribes and Pharisees. He talks to Sadducees. He talks to synagogue presidents, to sympathizers and skeptics and opponents, to devout Jews who even tithe their spices, with sinners such as tax collectors and prostitutes, with people who seek healing, with men and women, with children. Jesus is willing to talk to anyone who is, and he takes the initiative. He moves from place to place. He's not waiting for them to come to him. Although on many occasions, crowds of people actually came to Jesus. But then when they once asked him in Nazareth to stay, he says, no, I need to go. I need to, because others need to hear as well. So we need the teacher when we fish, and the teacher is Jesus. The third point of John Stott was fishermen use different methods, even in Galilee. You would use an angling rod, and then you could fish with a little net where you stand in the water on the shoreside and fish there. Or there was the drag net that you would attach between two boats. We have the parable of the drag net. And in that drag net, everything gets caught, including the Coca-Cola cans today. And then you need to do the sorting out at the end, because a Jew can't eat everything that moves in a lake. Because there are creatures in a lake that are not clean animals. And that's actually Jesus' point, that sorting out, that comes at the end. But now we fish. In other words, the gospel is addressed to all people. We don't say some people are excluded from the presentation of the gospel. And we don't judge people. God is the one who touches. He determines at the end who has really heard and accepted the gospel. We do gospel work. I always added a fourth point. Fishermen need patience. There's nothing more boring than watch a fisherman. Although at least on American television, on sports channels, you can watch fishing. And I just wonder whether they take 10-hour footage and compress it within like 5 minutes or something. I have no idea. Looks like it, that there's always some excitement, power fishing. I don't know what it is. I don't really watch it. But on occasion I have, to be able to use it as an illustration when I preach. So patience is needed. We, of course, had the example of the disciples once fishing, and they were pros, fishing an entire night and not catching anything. If you are a missionary among Muslims, it may take a very long time. I recall when I was working with Operation Mobilization many, many years ago, hearing Charles Marsh talk to us. One of the early, not early, but missionaries in the 50s, 60s, 70s, he could have had a brilliant idea, a career as a linguist in Oxford or Cambridge or somewhere. But he, you might, some people say, sort of buried himself in the sands of Algeria. He had to wait, I believe, 12 years, I think, for the first convert. And that convert was killed by the family within 12 years. Talk about patience. So we preach, whether there's a response or not. Now, of course, we could be stupid in what we do, and so we want to learn from others. The lack of response could simply be due to the fact that maybe we are not doing it right. But it's not really the right technique that determines these issues. In some cultures, it is simply very tough. There has never been a revival in Japan, even though hundreds of missionaries have worked in Japan over the years. My brother was there as a missionary for 12 years. And then you have Korea, not too far away from Japan, where there was a major revival and many Christians. And it's not because missionaries to Korea were better missionaries. They had a better technique. That's not the explanation. So we need patience. Some of you probably had children or have children. As parents, we need patience with children as well. Unless your children, you only need to say something once, and then they got it. That was not my children. We had to repeat again and again, like sit still or don't push your sister or something. So that's the metaphor of fishers for people. So we see Jesus involved with individuals. And of course, Jesus' instruction to the 12 when he sent them out on this mission, this short-term mission, reflects the model of Jesus' own activity. The target audience is specified in terms of ethnic cultural terms. The 12 are told to visit the lost sheep of the house of Israel, Jews specifically, and not Gentiles. This is changed later. The basic task involves going, proclaiming, curing, and casting out, curing diseases, casting out demons, and the stipulations concerning room and board. But Jesus says when you enter a village, when they are invited to stay in a house, they should greet their family and stay there. So these would be sympathizers of Jesus who had heard about Jesus. So that they could in that culture expect hospitality, which in a Roman or Greek culture you couldn't. So there things were different for Paul. This is why he says very often he was cold, because he might have to stay out in the open maybe overnight. So these stipulations highlight the local nature of the ministry of Jesus. It also indicates that this was a short-term mission, for Israel, that they shouldn't take any provisions because they wouldn't need them. They would get all they need from the people they preached to. Peter, let's talk about people. Peter and the people in Jerusalem, Samaria, and Judea. Matthew 16, verse 18, Jesus commissions Peter as the rock on whom he will build his church. In other words, Peter is designated as the one who leads the way in the mission from Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria to the ends of the earth. And when we look into Acts, now this is Matthew writing this up, Luke in his gospel doesn't have this passage interesting enough, because he writes about Peter later on. But this is exactly the function that Peter has in the book of Acts. He preaches in Jerusalem on Pentecost, later on several occasions. His visit to Samaria guarantees the reception of the Spirit, because the Spirit had been delayed in Samaria. He is doing missionary work in Judea, and he is the first, at least according to Luke's report, who talked to a Gentile, namely Cornelius, in Caesarea. And of course, he had this vision with these unclean animals, where God told the church through Peter not to regard Gentiles as unclean, not to shy away from contacts with Gentiles. There are several texts in the letter of Aristeas, a Jewish text, and then also Josephus, that they talk about these problems in contact between Jews and Gentiles. There were various options. If you were a Jewish businessman, obviously you had contact with Gentiles. You might even eat together, even in the house of the Gentile. If he knew that you are a Jew, he would maybe make provisions. Maybe you would eat only vegetables. That was innocuous. You could do that, vegetables and bread. Meat was relatively rare anyway, so there are some kind of foods were clean and unclean. It's much more of an issue, but it was a problem. If you're a scrupulous Jew, it was a huge problem. You try to, as a conservative, law-abiding Jew, you would try to minimize very probably these contacts, but not any longer. So that vision really opens up the path to an international mission. But when we look at details, there's the local mission in Jerusalem. We see Peter in an upstairs room in Jerusalem. Then he sits in a house in Jerusalem, chapter 2, verse 1. He stands before a large crowd of people, 2:14. He goes to the temple, 3:1. He is in Solomon's portico on the east side of the Temple Mount, chapter 3, 11, 5, 12, 20, 25, 42. He is in the prison of the Sanhedrin, 4:3. He is in the Sanhedrin hall, 4:7. He is in the public jail, 5:7. He is in Samaria, in the city in which Philip had been active, chapter 8. He is in Samaritan villages, 8:25. He is in Lydda, in the plain of Sharon, 9:32. He's in an upstairs room in Joppa, 9:38. He's in the house of a tanner named Simon in Joppa, 9:43. He's on the roof of that house, 10:9. He's on the road from Joppa to Caesarea, 10:23. He's in the house of Cornelius, 10:24. Then he's on the road from Caesarea to Jerusalem, 11:2. Then he's in the prison in Herod's palace, 12:3, and then he is in the house of Mary in Jerusalem, 12:12. So this is just going through the first 12 chapters of Acts, looking at the places, mentioning the places where Peter was. And of course, we could enlarge it. You could get a whole Bible study out of that little exercise. Say, what did Peter actually do? Now, of course, in prison, he didn't do evangelism, presumably. I mean, once he was there, although he might have been. When the other prisoner said, what are you doing here? Who are you? He would have explained. And the gospel would have been preached. So this is Peter. I now move to Paul. The geographical scope of Paul's missionary work was not controlled by a grand global strategy, such as focusing on big cities or Roman colonies, or on the regions in which the descendants of Japhet had settled. That is one suggestion. Or because he wanted to fill the program of Isaiah 66:19, another suggestion, trying to explain the geographical movement of Paul. Because if you look at details, which we don't have time doing here in my book, The Early Christian Mission, I discuss these proposals in detail. Parts of these proposals fit, but if one looks at the details, other parts do not really fit. One somewhat, at least in the popular imagination, influential suggestion has been that by Robert Allen in his book Missionary Methods, Paul or Ours, a very helpful book actually, although he doesn't really write on this point, but he mentioned that Paul focused on the big cities so that then the gospel would move to the rest of the province. That is unconvincing on two points. We will trace very quickly the steps of Paul's missionary work, and we'll see that Paul focused on bigger cities only later on. Of course, he was in Antioch, the third largest city of the Roman Empire, but he was invited by Barnabas, so there was not a strategic choice by Peter or by Paul. And then the other large cities would really only be Corinth and Ephesus. There he stayed for longer periods, and that was towards the end of his missionary work, before he was arrested and imprisoned. But he had worked as a missionary before that for nearly 20 years or so. And so there we don't see a focus on big cities. And then another line of argumentation would be, now if you are British or maybe French, then the idea of a big city, maybe the capital city like London or Paris, there you are present and create a movement, and then people go out to the rest of the country, might make sense when the country is centralized. It makes much less sense, for example, in the U.S. I mean, Washington is far away from Texas, from California, even from Boston. Very little, as a matter of fact, is decided in Washington that influences the rest of us. Very little. Taxation and obviously foreign affairs and the military, everything is local. There was one senator a long time ago who said in all politics is local politics, which is true. In terms of what the impact our lives. Also, Germany was not centralized for a very long time. Then after unification under Bismarck, 1871, there was Berlin, but there were still the regions very strong. And, which is of course much more important, in the first century, the capital city of a province might not be all that relevant. the governor was very rarely in the capital city. What did governors do? They traveled throughout the province holding court days. So there were these centers that they regularly visit. You would never know where you could meet the governor. And of course, cities, some of the famous old Greek cities in Asia Minor, they were independent. Cities like Pergamum, cities like Ephesus, cities like Tarsus, they had been granted autonomy. They controlled other towns and villages. And so for that structure, these towns and villages controlled, let's say, by Tarsus, they make sense. If you have a presence of the gospel in Tarsus, then on market days, the villagers would come and sell their products, and then they might hear the gospel. Or you would go to these villages and towns, or Christians might, and preach the gospel there. But if the gospel is in Tarsus, how would it get to Pergamum? Or how would it get to Anaxalbus, another city in Cilicia? Or if you stay within the province of Asia, if the gospel takes hold in Ephesus, why should people in Pergamum be interested? Because between these old Greek cities, there was intense competition. So there was no city dominating other cities. I mean, cities sometimes try in terms of getting the emperor support ventures that they were doing, like building an imperial temple. This was exactly the issue between Pergamum and Ephesus. They both wanted to have the privilege of building the first imperial temple in the province of Ephesus. Now, the emperors, since Augustus, had been worshipped, but in connection with other cults, or maybe in civic venues, but in order to be allowed to build a temple devoted to the worship of a particular emperor, you needed permission from Rome. And Pergamum got permission first. The argument was, well, Ephesus is already Theochoros. That was the term used, that one also then finds on coins, Theochoros, meaning the temple warden of a particular god, and therefore a city more important than other cities. That said, Ephesus is already Theochoros because there is the very famous temple of Artemis. But it was not an imperial temple. And so Pergamum was allowed to build an imperial temple, and it took several decades until Ephesus was allowed to build an imperial temple. So the gospel would not naturally move from Ephesus to Pergamum and Sardis, sort of by osmosis. You really have to go there and preach the gospel. And so the idea, you establish the gospel in a big city, and then it filters more or less, hopefully sooner rather than later, to other cities. This wouldn't really happen. I don't think it's really automatically happening today. You really need to go, even if you have a very strong center. There needs to be a personal contact and travel, but that would certainly be true in the first century. So let's look at the various phases of Paul's missionary work. I want to begin with that. These circles all represent the areas in which Paul did missionary work. So in terms of a grand strategy, as we will see, we might say that Paul worked his way from east to west. He wanted to go to Spain. He actually probably was released from prison. His imprisonment recorded in Acts. There are statements among early church traditions that suggest that he was probably released and then imprisoned again. We cannot be sure, but it is plausible. So Paul, in a general sense, moved from east to west. So first he was converted in Damascus. And we read that he preached in the synagogues of Damascus right away. I had activated the next picture, but sometimes it seems to work and sometimes not. Now, no excavations in Damascus have ever been done, and I never had a chance actually to visit Damascus. I thought about visiting 2 years ago, but even then it was too dangerous. It's a pity. These places are all very, very close. If you're in Antioch, Antakya, I mean, with a car, you would be in Damascus, I don't know, in probably 3 hours or so. It's close. 3 hours is close for people living in the U.S. Yeah. So why did he preach the gospel there? Well, he was converted, and so he preached where he was. That's what missionaries do, no matter where they are. Maybe sometimes even in an airplane, they preach the gospel. I had a friend when I was a theological student in Basel, an Austrian, who is a pastor of the Protestant Lutheran Church in Schladming, Austria, Gerd Krömer. And he is one of those who can't keep his mouth shut. He is just wonderful. So he sometimes, Sunday morning, going with a tramway, back from the church to the place where he lived, he would sometimes, not always, he would sometimes stand up and say, I was in church, the pastor had three rather interesting things to say, do you mind if I share? And then he would preach. For him, it was just natural. It's just what he did. He was that kind of person. Did Paul need to be trained to preach the gospel? He knew the gospel. Why? He persecuted Christians. He would not have persecuted Christians if he didn't know what they were preaching. So he knew exactly what they were preaching. He only didn't believe it. And of course, he was a great rabbi. He knew then once he came to faith how to relate the story of Jesus, the events of Jesus' life, especially death and resurrection, to Old Testament texts. He would have learned, he would have heard how early Christians like Stephen were doing that. He was involved in persecution. He was involved in arresting them, in interrogating them, in torturing them probably. And so he knew exactly the gospel, and therefore he could preach right away. Then Paul went to Nabatea. That is the second phase of his missionary ministry. Luke doesn't report it. He only says, after many days, there was a persecution in Damascus and he had to leave. So we deduce his mission in Nabatea from two passages. Galatians 1:17, where Paul says he went to Nabatea. Nabatea is Arabia. In the second century under Trajan, Nabatea actually became a Roman province with the name Arabia. It was a province that did not include Damascus, but it started just south of Damascus and went all the way south to Petra, which was the capital, basically the country of Amman. The country of Jordan, with the capital of Amman, the country of Jordan today. That would be Nabatea, although some of the Nabateans also lived in the Sinai Peninsula. In the northern Sinai Peninsula, there's a large Nabatean city that actually has been excavated to some degree. And that's the second passage, 2 Corinthians 11:32. Paul says that the ethnarch of King Aretas wanted to arrest him in Damascus. Now, ethnarch means representative. Who is Aretas? He is the king of the Nabateans. At that time, that was Aretas the IV. He reigned for a very long time, 50 or 60 years. Now, why would King Aretas want to arrest Paul? Not because he was meditating in the desert. This is maybe popularly how Christians understand. Yeah, Paul goes to Arabia. That means desert. So like Moses, Moses was taken to the desert in preparation, or Jesus went to the desert in preparation for his ministry. But people who meditate are not dangerous. They are never persecuted. It appears that what happened later in Paul's ministry happened there, that he preached in the Jewish communities because Jews lived in Nabatean cities also, and that he also preached to Gentiles because the Lord has called him to preach to Gentiles, and that then there was opposition by Jews, by Gentiles perhaps as well, and so there was unrest, and the Nabatean king heard about it, couldn't tolerate it, and therefore wanted to eliminate. So that's that reference to the King Aretas wanting to arrest him is really a proof. I would say a very strong indication that Paul was preaching the gospel. There are large excavations in Nabatea, and then he went to Jerusalem. So the third phase of his ministry, he went to Jerusalem. He met Barnabas, he introduced him to the other apostles. He met Paul, and he preached in the synagogues of Jerusalem, the same synagogues that Stephen had been active in. And they, some Jews in these diaspora synagogues, not diaspora, these synagogues were Greek-speaking Jews from the diaspora were worshipping. There was a synagogue of the Cilicians. And maybe this is where Paul had worshipped when he was a student in Jerusalem. So they do a plot against his life. They want to kill him. And it's actually rather moving when the Lord tells Paul in a vision to go and to go to the Gentile. Paul talks about that in his message, in his sort of defense speech in Acts 26. There Paul talks about this. And then he said to the Lord that, I'm paraphrasing, that I am a good candidate for preaching in Jerusalem, that I want to stay here. But God says to him, I have a people in other cities that you need to reach. So Paul really wanted to do evangelism more long-term in Jerusalem. He knew, he had contacts with the high priest, knew people, he had been there as obviously a very brilliant theological student or rabbinical student under Gamaliel, who was one of the most famous rabbis of the time. He had persecuted the church, but evidently his conversion was and his ministry was such that some of the Jerusalem Jews thought this should not be tolerated. Now, why did Paul first preach the gospel in Damascus? Well, he was there. Why Nabatea? That was right on the doorstep. And maybe he thought going back to Jerusalem was too dangerous at this point. Why then Jerusalem? Well, he had lived there the last few years, so he wanted to go there. And then they sent him to Tarsus. Okay, yeah, this is, I'm sure you know this picture. This is from the model of Jerusalem, from Jerusalem in the first century. It used to be outside of the Holy Land Hotel. Now it is in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. Jewish archaeologists had been working on this. This is according to scale, and you see the importance of the temple just from the sheer size of the building. And as you see these high walls, and this is the platform that Herod created where you could accommodate 70,000 people. The temple proper, I really should have a pointer, which I don't have. The temple proper is up here, surrounded by this immense court called the court of the Gentiles. They sent him then when he had to leave Jerusalem. There really should be a third circle for Damascus. I need to include that here as well, because we are in the fourth phase of Paul's missionary work. So Tarsus in Cilicia. Why Tarsus? Well, this is where his family lived. So it was natural to go there. When I went to Tarsus for the first time just over 10 years ago, I thought there was nothing to see. But just before that, they wanted to build a parking garage in the city center and discover this Roman road. And fortunately, they didn't cover it up. 30 years ago, they would have not bothered. But now they realize if you want to get tourists, if you can show them some ruins, then they go, some Christians will come. So there's this Roman road from the time of Paul and before, right in the middle of Tarsus today. And he was in Tarsus, if we do New Testament chronology, for about 10 years. When, after the Apostles' Council, Acts 15, he and Silas, after Barnabas and John Mark did their own thing going back to Cyprus, when he and Silas took the decision of the Apostles' Council to other churches, Luke reports that they went to the churches in Syria and Cilicia. Clear indication there were churches in Cilicia. And in Galatians 1, where Paul says that he left Jerusalem, he says, and they heard that the one who once persecuted them, he didn't know, the Christians in Judea didn't know him face to face. He was in Jerusalem for only a very short time, unfortunately for Paul. That they heard that the one who has persecuted them is now preaching the gospel And so if we take the Acts passage, Acts 15, together with the Galatians 1 passage, we see very clearly that Paul was active as a missionary. He was not a tent worker or was working in a secular profession. After all, God had called him to preach the gospel. And why would Barnabas go to Tarsus to recruit Paul for the ministry in Antioch if Paul had not been working as a missionary? What is actually interesting, it says in Acts 11 that Barnabas was looking, he went to Tarsus looking for Paul, and when he found him, he invited him to come to him. Now, why would it be difficult to find Paul in Tarsus? You go to the synagogue, and as a Jew, he would know where the synagogue that in Tarsus is or how to find it. And Tarsus was a somewhat big city, but there might have been multiple synagogues. But it would be very easy to find the family of Paul and to find Paul. You see, that remark may indicate that Paul was traveling throughout the province of Cilicia, visiting other cities, proclaiming the gospel in other cities, and therefore he needed to be found. Perhaps Tarsus was his base, because there were many cities in Jerusalem. Many cities in Cilicia. The maps in the backs of our Bibles are basically all lousy. Well, I shouldn't say that. They are small format, and so it's limited what you can put there. But you would think, if you look at these maps in any Bible, really, that in Cilicia you have only Tarsus and Issus. And Issus is usually included because there was that famous battle between Alexander the Great and the Persians in 333 BC. That's why Issus is included. At the time Issus was, there were other cities in Cilicia that are more important than Issus. Many Bible atlases don't give you much geographical information. If you are a map guy, and I like maps, I must confess, if you have a chance, it's somewhat expensive, actually, over $200, but if you are close to a university, look at the Barrington Atlas of the Greek-Roman World, published by Talbot, Princeton University Press, new edition 2000, I think exactly it came out. It replaced a 30-40-year-old Atlas of the Greek-Roman World by Calder, and Talbot's Barrington Atlas of the Greek-Roman World is really fantastic. It's unfortunately not on the web. Many people complain about that because how can you use that atlas in the classroom? Now, I took pictures with a digital camera, and then sometimes use it. We don't have time to go into these details here. There's actually a website devoted to the Barrington Atlas. Some of the basic maps are there, but not really. Because in these maps, they record it's topographical, first of all, which is extremely helpful, and everything is included in the map that we know, either from ancient literature, literary records, or from archaeology. Everything. Whether it's some temple on some mountain, whether it's a road, everything is in there. That's fantastic. And there you see how many cities there were in the first century in Cilicia. A lot of space for evangelism. And of course, and this is one of the selective reporting of Luke, he never reports in Acts that the apostles or Paul worked in villages. In the Gospel of Luke, he talked about villages all the time. Yeah, not all the time, but villages, towns and villages are mentioned frequently, small places, but not in Acts. So one gets the impression they focused on the cities, but this is probably only due to Luke's selective reporting. Because the disciples would have learned from Jesus not to focus on the big cities, but to go to all places, to go to towns and villages. As a matter of fact, if we go back to the Gospel of Luke, the two largest towns in, one cannot really call them cities, well, sort of. The two largest towns in Galilee are not even mentioned in the Gospels, Sebaste and Tiberias. Various explanations have been given. It was probably out of political considerations, Jesus not wanting to risk a confrontation with the ruler, Herod Antipas, too early. He avoided him. Because Sebaste was the first capital of Antipas, and then he built a new capital right on the Sea of Galilee in Tiberias. That's the best way. Others have suggested Jesus' ministry there was not successful, so it's embarrassing, and therefore this is being suppressed. But Jesus' ministry in Chorazim and Bethsaida was also not successful. Now, they were not very big towns, but still was not successful, and so judgment is being pronounced. There's nothing embarrassing about not receiving a hearing in a particular town. The New Testament authors are not shy at all about talking, mentioning opposition to Christian preachers. So Paul's ministry in Tarsus was probably rather widespread. And then he was recruited by Barnabas to preach in Antioch. He stayed there for 2 or 3 years or so. Antioch, the third largest city in the Roman world. There was first Rome, maybe 1 million inhabitants. As a matter of fact, in the history of mankind, you need to, and I think it includes China, although I'm not sure about the inhabitants of Beijing, during the Middle Ages, for example, but at least concerning the West, one needed to wait until the 19th century for another city to have 1 million. There was London. Only 19th century, London 1 million. So Rome first century, that was a big deal, 1 million people. Largest city in the world, I mean the Western world at least, had ever seen. Second came Alexandria, and third, Antioch. No excavations have been done in Antioch proper. There is a nice field museum of archaeology. I mean, in some gardens, in the backs of houses, maybe when they were digging, they found some column. And actually, in a suburb of Antioch, a villa section was excavated from a little town called Daphne, where the rich people live. A very beautiful mosaic that you would find. So this is modern Antakya, Antioch. The capital of province of Syria, and there they ministered among Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians. And of course we know from Acts, this is where the Christians were first called Christians. The word Christianoi, the Greek term, is quite obviously derived from Latin. It seems to have a Latin origin. Not the word Christos, that is Greek for the anointed one or Messiah in Hebrew. But the ending, Christianoi, obviously a party term describing a party, because in Greek you would take a name and make it into a party term. The formulation would be different. So it's obviously, well, it's obviously coined by Romans. So it seems that the expansion of the church in Antioch came to the attention of the authorities. Maybe there was opposition, maybe there was a court case, and so the Romans needed a label for this group. Especially perhaps if the Jews said, well, they are not really Jews. There are many pagans part of this group, so it seems. And the Jews would not have used the word Christianoi anyway. They would have said the Nazarenes. This is what later when Paul is accused, they used the Nazarenes. Paul is the leader of the sect of the Nazarenes. They wouldn't use the word Christos Messiah, because they don't believe it. It took the church, it was only in the mid-second century that Christians used it as a label for themselves. In Acts, in the very early church fathers, well, not church fathers, but apostolic fathers, we call them, they don't use the word Christians. They use other terms like the way or the church, ecclesia, or the brothers. So we have Antioch. The next phase of Paul's ministry was then Cyprus. Why did Paul and Barnabas move to Cyprus? Any ideas? Why did they go to Cyprus? Exactly. Very good. Barnabas was from Cyprus. And when the persecution after Stephen's execution forced Greek-speaking Jews from Jerusalem to leave Jerusalem. Luke says earlier in Acts chapter 8 that some reach Cyprus. That means that when Paul and Barnabas get to Cyprus, maybe there were already churches there. See, they might not have been the original missionaries. Because what was Barnabas's task going from Jerusalem to Antioch to consolidate the church? This is what he might have wanted to do, to go to Cyprus to consolidate the churches that had been established at Mount Luke doesn't tell us, but it's a plausible inference. And it's extremely plausible that they went there exactly because of Barnabas. So again, the point was not let's go to a big city, because then Paul have done different things and not go to an island of all places. And in Cyprus, they were not really big cities. This is when I went into space. I took this picture from Cyprus. No, I wish, but I found this on the internet. They landed in Salamis, which was here on the eastern side of Cyprus, and then they worked their way. There was a coastal road. Cyprus is somewhat mountainous, as you can see here, so there are hardly any north-south connections. They walked on the southern road and came to Paphos, which was here. And again, you can actually go to the Barrington Atlas of the Greek-Roman world and look at Cyprus in the Roman period, and you see how many towns there were. They preached in Salamis in the synagogues. As Luke mentions, that we have to assume a church was established. But there were other cities where maybe Paul and Barnabas preached as well. So Paphos, there are a few excavations. Sometimes this gets stuck. A few excavations on Cyprus, the ruins of Salamis. That's a picture from the internet. I've never had the privilege to visit Cyprus. And then Paphos, also a picture from the internet, the harbor of Paphos, the theater has been excavated, a few other structures as well. Okay, and then from Paphos, they went to Pisidian Antioch. Why that? Why they moved? Why not go to Perga first? Perga was actually a big city, much bigger than Antioch. Now you could say Pisidian Antioch was a Roman colony, Perga was not, but there's no indication that Paul wanted to go to a Roman colony. There was no particular advantage to go to a Roman colony. You could argue, well, but Paul was a Roman citizen, so he had protections, certain protections from just being arrested. But that protection would work in any place in a Roman province, and not just in the Roman colony. Roman colony only meant that the veterans of the army were settled there. Sometimes these were completely new towns. Sometimes a colony was added to an already existing city. Like Derby. Derby had existed, actually Antioch had existed already, and then veterans were settled there. You see, that became a huge problem with Julius Caesar and Augustus. They had assembled huge armies in Republican Rome. Armies were, there was no standing army. Roman citizens would defend Rome whenever there was an outsider enemy. And so they would leave their fields, get together, they would bring their own weapons, and then they would. But Caesar really was a power-hungry guy, and the Republic was falling apart politically anyway as a result of various developments. And so he kept an army, which was very unusual anyway. It became bigger and bigger. Then there was, of course, after his murder, the Civil War, there was Civil War before Caesar, or during the time of Caesar, after his murder, war then between especially Pompey and Augustus, and so they both had huge armies, like several hundred thousand people, for many years, not just for a fighting season, for many years. And then the question was, what do you do with that? Especially as Augustus kept the standing army, that was completely new. So therefore the Roman Empire was really a monarchy, also a dictatorship, you might say, a monarchical dictatorship based on the power of the military. This is why the Senate was essentially powerless. And so promises were made that after serving for so many years, they would be settled. Like, depending on how important you were, if you're a knight, you would be one of the commanders, you would have a different career anyway. If you were just a normal foot soldier, you would serve 20 or 25 years, and then you were promised a land and tax exemption and money and then you will sort of set. Although you might be 50 at the time, but still. The problem was actually in Italy, there was no land to be distributed very quickly. That was a big problem of Augustus initially, settling the veterans of Julius Caesar's army. So in the provinces, colonies were formed, but there was no particular advantage of preaching the gospel there. These were former military people, and they would not be more receptive or less receptive to the gospel. They might be more likely to be Latin-speaking, although settling in Asia Minor, they would have to be able to communicate as well. So why would Paul go from Paphos to Pisidian Antioch? This is how he went. I'm so proud of this line that I managed to. I needed the advice of myself. See, there are other big cities like Perge, Aspendos, Side, Etena, Selge, Kremna, Adada, Sagalassos, Comana, Ariassos, Termessos. Maybe you've never heard of these cities. Termessos was the only city Alexander the Great didn't conquer. They were very proud. Immensely impressive ruins, not excavated, up in the mountains. When I was there again 2 years ago, I was there basically by myself, but no other tourists there, no guard, nothing. I mean, you need to pay entrance at the bottom when you drive up, but there's no one there. Sagalassos, the Belgians have been excavated there, a wonderful city with full infrastructure, looking out. But Paul bypassed all these cities and made a beeline to Antioch. So he didn't go city by city, he didn't, at least on this occasion, not go to the biggest city, because that would have been Perge. On Cyprus, in Paphos, Sergius Paulus was converted. And there's inscriptional evidence that the family of the Sergii Pauli owned estates in Antioch. So members of Sergius Paulus' family lived there, had estates there, and so we can assume that he gave letters of introduction to his relatives. And therefore, Paul wanted to go there immediately. Maybe Sergius Paulus even sent an envoy informing them about the Paul arriving. This is not just me saying that. In Romans commentaries, you won't really find that outside of my commentary. I discussed that also in early Christian mission. But there have been others. Stephen Mitchell is one of the foremost experts on Asia Minor, Anatolia. He wrote a two-volume work on Anatolia. And this is what he says very likely happened. Because it fits into how things worked in the ancient world. Now, of course, in Paphos, the governor was converted. Sort of aristocracy mission, you could. In Antioch, the Jews who opposed Paul, they got in league with the women of high standing who were attending the synagogue, and they got in contact with their husbands, and they made sure Paul left the city. So aristocracy mission in Pisidian Antioch didn't work, but it might have been the reason why Paul went there. There might be a second reason, Paul says, when he writes to the Galatian churches, that he went there because of an illness. Now, there's been much speculation what Paul's illness was. It's probably a reference to or should be connected with the thorn in the flesh that Paul talks about in 2 Corinthians that God gave him. I think the most plausible explanation is that given by Ramsay in the 19th century, accepted by F.F. Bruce, and others, that it was malaria. Because malaria is very debilitating, you get it again and again. Because Paul says he prayed 3 times. And he certainly doesn't mean he prayed at 6 a.m., at noon, and at 6 p.m. There was still no healing then, he gave up praying. I mean, we persist in prayer. But malaria, you might suffer from malaria, then you are okay for a few months, then you get it again. And so maybe after the third attack, maybe after 2-3 years, Paul realized, well, I'm stuck with this. God doesn't want to heal me. And he wants to show his power in the midst of this weakness. The only relief from malaria was to go to higher areas. And so this was the coastal area. Perge would be coastal area, but Antioch is in the Anatolian highlands, substantially high. That's the only thing you really could do at the time. We don't know for sure, but that family connection between Sergius and Paulus, and that family having estates in Pisidian Antioch, that is a rather attractive and convincing explanation. This is one of the main streets of Antioch. At the end of this road, you have a large imperial temple. And look at this theater and keep that in mind. We'll have a picture of Perge in just a second. Well, maybe 10 seconds or 20. So this is really a very, very small theater. But this is Pisidian Antioch. Then Paul went to obviously, Iconium. This is Iconium in the valley. There's always been a city. Actually, today, they say Iconium is like the Bible Belt in the U.S. for very conservative Muslims in Turkey. If you go there, you really see women with the hijab, which in Istanbul you also see, but rarely. And they may be tourists from the Gulf State. Konya, as it is called. So there is a nice museum with finds from the area. Then he went to Lystra. So he just walked on the Via Sebastian, the main road. He walked back towards houses, you might say. He was chased out. So why would he go to Lystra? Well, he was chased out of Antioch. Then he went to the next city, the next larger city, Lystra, well, Iconium, and then to Lystra, where he was stoned. Then he went to Derby. There's nothing on Derby to see. We needed to use GPS to locate Derby when I was there 10 years. I missed it. I didn't have the GPS coordinate on it. There was actually some discussion Derby is as well. That's a tell. You stand on top of it and you realize if you would start digging, you would find something. Probably not something very exciting, but no one ever did. If you see the high mountains in the back, it's, if you ever have a chance to visit Turkey, do so. You can organize a trip to Turkey yourself privately, no problem. There's a Blue Guide series, guides, I mean, for many parts of the world, Blue Guide, that focuses on archaeological and cultural information. And then if you take the Lonely Planet guides for accommodation, this is sort of for the backpacking crowd if you want to do it on the cheap, which is what I was doing. Our kids came along 2 years ago, and in a few places, my daughter said, "Dad, that's really roughing it." But she knew it was cheap, because if you do an official tour, official Christian tour, then these deals are very expensive. You would pay maybe $4,000, $5,000 for 2 weeks or so. But you could easily do 3 weeks on much less, or maybe even half. Because if you stay in little pensions, it's just wonderful. Turks are so friendly. Anyway. I am not making PR for some travel thing, but you really can organize that yourself. It's not really a big deal. I don't know sometimes. And then after visiting these cities on the Anatolian Highland, Antioch, Iconium, Lystra, Derbe, then he did missionary work in Perge. This is always neglected. Now, Luke has only half a verse on that. That then he went to Perge in chapter 14, Acts chapter 14. Maybe I should read this in detail, because the detail is not really all that huge. Verse 24, chapter 14, 24. After going through Pisidia, he came into Pamphylia, new province. And when they had preached the word in Perge, they went down to Attaleia, which was the harbor city. Now, when Luke says they preached, he seems to indicate that they established a church. Why otherwise mention that they preached it? Luke is selective. He's very selective. You see, in some of the a study you can do, look at all the places Paul visited and list the details that Luke mentioned. Sometimes, very rarely, he gives names of converts. Sometimes he does. So Sometimes he mentions only that there is preaching, and sometimes he tells a story about what happened. It's not stereotypical at all what he does. So he went to Pergi, that was a new province, that is the downtown Pergi, and that is the theater of Pergi. Now remember the theater of Pisidian Antioch, this little affair for maybe 2,000 people, 20,000 people or so, I think, could sit there. An immense theater, quite well preserved. The stage part, very well preserved. It went up to the height usually of the highest bleachers. In most places, like Miletus, that part has completely disappeared. People used the stones for their own building, or as roadblocks, maybe. So Paul preached in Pergi as well. The next phase where Paul wanted to go was Asia, the province of Asia. And here we get the impression, now he visited, of course, Jerusalem and Antioch, and then went back. He revisited the churches in the Anatolian Highland, and now we see Paul wants to move from east, from east to west. And that might be the reason why he wants to go to the province of Asia. And he might have chosen a southerly route, that would have taken him to Colossae, Laodicea, there was another Antioch, Magnesia, and then all the way to Ephesus. He might have chosen a more central road. So here a picture of Laodicea, the stadium. I apologize for the typo. I never noticed that typo. It's terrible. And actually, in Laodicea, since just two or three years, major excavations have been going on. And I was there 2 years ago. I was really blown away, because when I was there 10 years ago, there was nothing. They are really digging there like crazy. Tralles, a city maybe you have never heard of. There was a church at the end of the first century in Tralles. We do know that from Paul could have chosen a middle route, taking him to Sardis, Magnesia on the Meander, and to Pergamon. So there were all kinds of possibilities. When we say Paul wanted to go to the province of Asia, we shouldn't think he targeted Ephesus. So a big city, that idea. Because there were many other important cities. Sardis was a royal city, formerly. Pergamon was a former royal city. So this is Sardis, the famous temple of Artemis there, and then Pergamon, the Acropolis of Pergamon. The city was at the foot of the hill, the very steep theater, and then an imperial temple on top, and the palaces of the former Pergamese kings. But the Holy Spirit prevented that, and so instead he wanted to go to Bithynia and Pontus, wanted to go north. But the Holy Spirit prevented that as well, and so he went on a north. Now this would mean going to Bithynia via Kotieion, Dorylaion, and Nicaea, where later the first church council was held in AD 325. But instead, he traveled on a northerly route via Adramyttium and Assos to Troas. And there he received the vision to cross over to Europe. This is the harbor of Troas. A few excavations have been done. And so Paul ends up first in Philippi, in the province of Thessalonica. So Philippi was a full Roman city, not too large, but an important city, because Augustus had won a decisive victory over Pompey in the near Philippi. Therefore, Philippi is very often mentioned in the ancient record. Philippi was the province, in the province of Macedonia, at the front, at the huge forum, the center of the city. What we see in the back was actually a later church from the 4th and 5th century. So there were Christians in Philippi in large numbers later on. There were actually several churches in Philippi. Then from Philippi, and why did he leave? Why would he preach in Philippi? Well, that's the first city you get to when you cross over to Europe from Troas, the first city you reach. Then he was beaten, imprisoned. He had to leave. Where did he go? He traveled on the main road and came to Thessalonica. These are they sort of one city block in the center. There you have excavations. That was the forum. That was here a subterranean warehouse that was accessible at the end here. That was the seat of the city council. Paul and the Christians, the pressure was put on them, and Paul, actually Jason and some others have to post bail for Paul, they leave during the night. They realize things are dangerous for Paul. And so where does he go? See, Paul walked from Philippi to Thessalonica. He could have carried on that main road to Pella, which was the old capital at the time of Alexander the Great, and gone on to Edessa. That road was called Via Ignatia. And he actually could have continued on that road to the coast and then take a ship to Italy. That was the standard way from Italy to go to the east on that road. So if Paul would want to focus on big cities, strategic routes, then this is what he would do. He did not do that. So this is Pella. I never had a chance to go to Pella. I got this from the internet, so I don't know who that fellow is with the red hair. He could have simply gone south to Methone and Pydna and then target Athens, which later he did. But instead, Paul traveled to Berea. You might say that's a dead end. Why did he travel to Berea? Well, his life was had been in danger in Philippi, in Thessalonica. And it says that Jews, surely Jewish Christians from Thessalonica, took him to Berea, probably to relatives there, just to make him safe. By Paul being a missionary, he preaches the gospel there as well. So that was not a strategic decision. That was not a big city. It's against the mountain, or halfway, not halfway up the mountain, but against the mountain, actually called Bermion Mons. This is a picture, actually, if you wonder some of these pictures of this. So they are from the Barrington Atlas of the Greek-Roman world, where you see the amazing amount of detail that they include in this. In Berea, there's a nice archaeological museum. There were just some articles on that. Then Paul moved south and preached in Athens. Many think Athens was just Paul waiting for Timothy and Silas, which is true, and that he just, as a missionary, he sort of shared the gospel on the side. But it appears that Athens was a bona fide goal of his missionary work. Now, some say even if that was the case, he was not successful. But I beg to differ. Two names of converts for Athens are mentioned. Dionysius and Damaris. Dionysius, a member of the Areopagus Council. For hardly any other church, Paul Luke mentions the names of converts. And of course, Luke says, in Acts 17, that Paul went to the synagogue to preach to the Jews and to the marketplace to preach to Gentiles. So Paul did what apparently he always did. So this was a church planting event. The problem is that brings people to say this whole thing was not successful, that the church in Athens is not really mentioned until relatively late. But people assume if there had been a church in Athens, it would be mentioned. But this underestimates the fact, this assumption implies another assumption, namely that Athens is so important that if there had been a church, it would be mentioned. Now, Athens, of course, we all know Athens. If you studied in maybe a history course, a Greek culture, you study Athens. But Athens was only one of other Greek cities. And the heyday of Athenian culture was only 50 years. Actually, there's even a Greek term for this period, meaning the period of the Greeks. That's where you have Aristotle and Plato, and where you have Phidias, the sculptor, where you have Sophocles, Euripides, and all these people. It was just a period of 50 years. And that was in the 5th century BC. Now we are over 400, we are 500 years later, 400 years later. And Athens was really a sleepy old university town, you might say. As a matter of fact, some Roman families send their children for university rather to Tarsus than to Athens. Athens had fallen into sort of disrepair. Augustus tried to help Athens because he wanted to be a champion of Greek culture and subsidize building programs, which prompted Herod the Great also giving money for financing building projects in Athens. So there were statues of Herod the Great in Athens because he had supported Mark Antony in the Civil War. And so he bet on the wrong horse, so to speak. So Augustus was victorious, so he wanted to support a project that Augustus was supporting. But that indicates Athens was really nothing in the place. So there's no reason why we should expect a church in Athens to be mentioned all the time in the second or third or even fourth century. So Paul did church planting in Athens, this of course is a picture of Athens. You would know the main entrance to the Acropolis, and then the Parthenon in the back, the Erechtheion, another important temple, and down below you would have you had Athens proper, the city, with the Forum and the marketplace. Then he went to Corinth, one of the main roads here, main streets in Corinth, and we all know about Corinth. Then Paul ministered in Ephesus, and I want to really speed up here. And of course, we know about Paul's ministry in Ephesus. Now, why did he choose Athens and Corinth? These were there, you might say, that was big city mission. Well, Athens not so much, but Corinth, although Corinth was not particularly huge. It was an old city. It was destroyed because Corinth led a league of Greek cities resisting the Romans, 184 BC. And for over 100 years, Corinth lay waste, more or less. Not completely, but. And then it was Julius Caesar who rebuilt it, reestablished it as a Roman colony. And so therefore, when we read 1 Corinthians, we should read Corinth not as a Greek city, but as a Roman city. And so when you come to 1 Corinthians 11 and the whole discussion about head covering, don't discuss what the old Greeks would have done, but what the Romans would do, because it was a Roman city. Most inscriptions of the first century from Corinth are in Latin. That starts to change in the late first and then second century when more and more Greeks settled again in Corinth. Corinth was actually the capital city of the province of Achaia. So he did do missionary work in the two largest cities and the two arguably most important cities at the time in the province of Achaia. And then he went back to Ephesus. He had wanted to go there before. We don't know whether other people had done church planting. Aquila and Priscilla actually were in Ephesus. Paul had visited earlier, but then he had done this other missionary work. So Aquila and Priscilla actually may have started a church, but he then stayed in Ephesus for about 3 years. This is the state agora, this whole area, the state agora of Ephesus, and here one a basilica on one side. The state agora would have been was surrounded on all four sides with a two-story basilica. The famous theater of Ephesus, that of course you know and I'm sure have seen pictures of. This was Harbour Road, and the Mediterranean would have come up to here in antiquity. The ocean is further out now. Mediterranean is further out. There's been silting going on even in antiquity already, but the sea level is different. It was different in antiquity than it is today. This is only one part, obviously, of downtown Ephesus. Then Paul went back to Jerusalem for the collection. He was in prison in Caesarea, so therefore a box, he's in prison, but he still preaches the gospel. He preaches the gospel. One, I think of the very perhaps most memorable events is described by Luke in Acts 26. Paul has already appealed to go to Rome and be tried by the emperor, so he knows he is safe. There was a new governor who was playing games, wanting to make nice with the Jews, so he knew that might be a very difficult proposition if he wants to transfer me back to Jerusalem, which he doesn't want to have. So he appeals to the emperor, and then Agrippa, that is Agrippa II, who is a king by title. He has a few lands further north, otherwise he is basically responsible for the high priestly garments. He's not really a king of Judea or Galilee. He has no jurisdiction over Paul. He's a Jew, but he was brought up in Rome. He's more Roman than Jewish, as a matter of fact. But as he is on a visit to welcome the new governor, Festus wants to have another hearing with Paul so that he would be able to write a report to Rome, which is what he wanted to do. So Paul explains his case. And as you know, he explains the resurrection of Jesus. It talks about the death of Jesus, the resurrection of Jesus. And then he addresses the king and says, King, you believe that, don't you? And Agrippa says, do you think you could convert me in such a short time? And Paul essentially says yes. Paul has no qualms in talking to poor people, but he doesn't mind wanting to convert the rich and famous and whether they have no title or the title of the king. Now, Agrippa is not converted. So Paul preaches the gospel in Caesarea, then he is taken to Rome. This is actually Caesarea, the stadium, the theater. The palace of Herod was built in this area. This was called the Promontory Palace. This was a swimming pool built by Herod the Great. And when Judea became a Roman province, Caesarea was established as capital, and so Herod's palace was used as the seat of the governor. And there's actually some evidence that there was a prison in the Praetorium. So Paul would have been in prison in this area. Whether he was free to walk around the city, that we do not know, but he did communicate the gospel to some. Then, of course, there was the journey to Malta. There were healings on Malta, although Luke doesn't talk about that the gospel was preached. Although we can assume that Paul did preach the gospel, because why would he heal people without talking about Jesus? He would heal in the name of Jesus. But Luke does not mention that. That is so-called St. Paul's Bay on Malta. And looking at the topography of that stretch of the coast and carefully at Luke's account of the shipwreck in Acts 27, it is actually plausible that the tradition that this was the site of Paul's shipwreck is actually authentic. It's very likely. And then Paul went to Rome, where obviously he was a prisoner for 2.5 years. We also learned that people visited him, Jews visited him. He had surely contact with a wide range of people. So there was also a proclamation of the gospel going on in a prison context in Rome. This is the Forum in Rome with various temples. And then Paul may have been released, and he may have managed to get to Spain. We do not know. He wanted to go there. Why to Spain and why not to Gallia, a Roman province since a long time? Massilia, perhaps. It's easy to get from Rome to this place. Either you take a ship or you walk. There was a nice, large Roman road along the coast. We don't know. That's somewhat mysterious. If Paul had wanted to, maybe because he thought Jesus is coming back very soon and the end of the earth, and that is Spain on in this area, that needs to work. Maybe because of that. We have no way of knowing. Maybe there were other missionaries working in Galilee. They could be, because Paul at that time didn't want to work in areas where the gospel was already being preached. This is a drawing of what Tarragona today, the city still exists, what that looked like with a forum in the back, a main temple, a stadium, a theater. The theater has been preserved. And so if you take all that evidence together, that's what we saw at the beginning. We see Paul had evidently, you see what Paul did is that he covered the northern Mediterranean in a circle from east to west, bypassing Gallia, why we do not know, also not preaching in Dalmatia and Thrace and Dalmatia, Roman provinces. There were Greek Roman cities there, there were Roman colonies there. Because from Macedonia, that actually would have been somewhat natural to simply move north here. Maybe there were other missionaries, or maybe he wanted to, obviously from Macedonia it was natural to go south to Achaia. Maybe he just wanted to make a beeline to Spain to reach the ends of the earth. So some of these details we don't know. And of course when we talk about local work, what Paul actually did, we would spend a long time. But you know Acts, and you know some of the events that happened. Luke emphasizes different things, sometimes like in Ephesus, miracles that happened, and then that opposition that drew that crowd into the stadium as they were shouting for hours, greatest Artemis of Ephesus. For Corinth, Luke focuses on the legal, first of all, on the departure from the synagogue, and then on the legal issue with the governor, where Jews tried to put him on trial, that then was entirely unsuccessful. So this is in a rough outline the missionary work of Jesus and of Peter and of Paul. There are many, many more details, obviously, that we could talk about. But let's have a conversation. We have 20 minutes. Anything you would maybe you think I could help you out, giving you more information. You could read my early Christian mission. Actually, the German version is cheaper than the English version. It's one of the very few books where the German original is cheaper than the English. Because in Germany, we published it in a single volume. And it's also in my contract that I don't earn any money on it. They print it on thin Bible paper, therefore you could, in one volume, accommodate 1,700 pages. Why is that? In English, they printed in two volumes. That made it more expensive. Why was that project so large? Well, because no one had written a synthetic study of the early Christian mission. That's why. No one had ever done that, which is actually a scandal. At the time when I was writing, there was not even a decent book about Paul as a missionary. There was a couple of titles that were somewhat helpful, but not really investigating everything that is relevant to be investigated for Paul. Not only his theology, I mean, this is what we usually do, but also looking at social factors, geographical factors, historical matters. That's why that project got so large.